I'll call the meeting of the Environmental Quality Board to order. You should have members in your packet a copy of the agenda and also a copy of the October, how time flies, October 16th, 2013 meeting minutes. I would be happy to entertain a motion to approve those unless you would like me to read them to you.
In that case, I'll move approval.
All right.
Second.
All right. That was fast. Is there further discussion on the motion to approve the agenda and the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I'd like to, first off, recognize our newest ex officio member on the Environmental Quality Board, Sandy Rummel. Sandy comes to us from the Met Council, and Sandy is originally from the White Bear Lake area, is a retired business owner of a small communications firm. Currently, she chairs the Met Council's Environment Committee. She also represents the Council on the Clean Water Council and at the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition. Previously, Sandy served one term in the Minnesota Senate, and as a member of the Senate Environment Committee, she carried a number of bills related to water and environmental issues. I'm also a short-term, two-term member of the Minnesota Senate, and as I was mentioning to Linda and Jason, I left right after I figured out that every now and then an innocent person is sent to serve, and I suspect you did much the same.
I'm looking for new material, Commissioner.
There you go.
That's all.
There
you go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still good. Don't stop.
She chaired the first subcommittee on legacy funding for clean water. She has developed a deep interest in issues related to water, energy, and the environment. Sandy holds a doctorate in leadership, policy, and administration from the University of St. Thomas and was an adjunct faculty member there for 6 years. Sandy Rummel also served 9 years on the White Bear Lake Area School Board, and I can also relate to that. I recognized early on as a member of the Board of Education, my little hometown of Murdoch, and that was to never go in the liquor store after 10 o'clock at night because everything was your fault. So I went at 9, anyhow. She also was chair of the East Metro Integration School District for the past 5 years, so please help me in welcoming our newest ex officio member to the board. One of the reasons, and the GICD, the governor's, what do you call it, Will? Governor's
Institute on Community Design.
Institute on Communities Design made a recommendation that we reach out to the Met Council and ask the Met Council to participate. Now, interestingly enough, they're more than happy to take credit for that, but we actually, many members and this board also concurred with that discussion before the GICD actually made the recommendation. So we sort of fed them that, and so we'll take a little bit of credit for having the Met Council here. So many things that we do affect you and the board that you represent. So again, welcome to the Environmental Quality Board. Let us start with some introductions. Brian, let's start over here and make a quick trip around the board, and then we'll go right to our agenda.
My name is Brian Nafstad. I'm the chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I would like to apologize in advance. I do need to sneak out at about 2 o'clock for a wetland mitigation meeting.
Red light means mute. I'm Tom Landwehr, the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
John Saxhog, I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner.
Katie Clark-Sieben, Commissioner of Deed.
Kristen Weeks-Dunkinson, citizen member from Southern Minnesota.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Spencer Cron, Commissioner for Administration.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
I'm Leah Hedman. I'm the Assistant Attorney General that represents the Environmental Quality Board.
I'm Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Agriculture.
Will Seufert, Executive Director for the Environmental Quality Board.
Sandy Romo, Metropolitan Council.
I'm Eric Tomlinson, citizen member also from the Twin Cities.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
John Stein, Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. And I also apologize, I have to leave around 3.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you. And I'm so proud of this board because, look, they're all here. That's an amazing thing. And so, again, it just it speaks to the value of the board and how important folks within Governor Dayton's cabinet and those citizen members appointed feel about the work that we do here today. I'm going to ask, rather than I sort of did my little report to introduce Sandy, but I think I'm going to ask Will to go directly to his executive director's report, and hopefully you can maybe mention some of the public meetings that we did since our last meeting, and also some new staff members that are coming on board.
Sure.
Will?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been a pretty busy month here for us. I just want to thank the commissioners and the staff that helped both set up and facilitate the meetings in southern Minnesota. We had 3 in late October in Wabasha, St. Charles, and Mankato that were really well attended. Thought they were really productive meetings, a lot of good information there, and just wanted to, again, reiterate our appreciation to the commissioners who personally attended and the staff that put in a lot of hours to get those off the ground. A couple other things kind of I wanted to just point up that came about since our last meeting. At the end of October, we learned that we are one of 4 states that will be participating in a National Governors Association project that it's a clean energy and economic development policy academy. Essentially what it does is they're going to work with us and provide some technical assistance and some resources through a year-long effort to weave together our clean energy policies and build an economic development strategy around them. And so this is a really exciting project that we're on this coming Monday, we'll be working with NGA. They're coming in town to help scope this project. And so I just wanted to put this on everyone's radar. We'll have a more thorough presentation as we get more details about what the deliverables will be in the timeline. So I just want to also thank Deed and Commerce for their hard work in trying to help put this whole thing together and get it moving. Quick staffing update. I'm really excited to announce that we've filled 2 positions, one to manage the environmental impact statement for the Minnesota Sands project in southeastern Minnesota. Denise Leeser is going to be joining us as the project manager, and I think I saw her in the crowd, so if you can just wave, Denise. I'm really excited we were able to bring Denise on board. I'll read her bio real quick for everybody. Denise has been employed with the MPCA for the past 17 years, working in the air quality, environmental review, and watershed programs. Her professional experience includes permit writing, project and grant management, representing the MPCA on numerous internal and external teams, and as the team lead developing environmental assessment worksheets and environmental impact statements for a wide variety of projects. Prior to the MPCA, Denise's first job after college was with the Physics Department at the University of Minnesota, where she assisted with the construction of a particle detector at Brookhaven National Laboratory. Denise lives in Minneapolis, is an avid gardener, and has spent much of her free time volunteering with various groups in her community. Welcome. I'm also pleased to announce that we have offered a position to Megan Eichen, and she's accepted to be a communication specialist for the EQB. She's going to start on December 2nd. Megan's also here, and I'll read quickly her bio.
Nobody saw her.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you for slowing me down. Hopefully we don't scare either of you away today. Megan started in radio broadcasting at 16 in her home state of Iowa. She went on to receive a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Northern Iowa in electronic media communications. From there, she worked for the Minnesota Broadcasters Association, where she was the producer of the public affairs show Access Minnesota, providing an in-depth look at current events and interviews with movers and shakers around the state. Eichen spent close to 5 years as the webmaster for the Metro District of MnDOT, working on projects ranging from the St. Croix River crossing to the I-35W bridge reconstruction. Most recently, she worked on a joint venture between PBS and TPT called Next Avenue, a website aimed at baby boomers as a communications and research specialist. For the last 10 years, she has taught web and broadcasting classes as an adjunct at Brown College. So welcome, Megan. And in addition, three other positions that we're going to be filling, the postings have closed, and we'll be looking to do interviews throughout the month of December and hope to have those filled by the end of the year. So one last thing before we get going on the rest of the agenda. Our next meeting in December, we're not having a full board meeting. We're just going to have the Silica Sand Subcommittee gather at the same time and same place. So for all the board members who are not on the Silica Sand Subcommittee, you are welcome to take advantage of that time to do Christmas shopping and whatnot. And then, you know, the agenda for that's going to be to look at the model standards. The draft is scheduled to be released by that point. And then finally, we're looking in January to, we're working closely with Professor Seely about trying to do a field trip and having our board meeting in at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus to try and connect some of the research and folks over at the university that are working on various projects that intersect with some of the things that we're working on here. So details will follow on that, assuming it works logistically. So that's all I've got. Thanks.
All right. Also on the agenda, I'd like to insert, after the silica sand update, I'd just like to insert a time for a public comment. So if there's someone that would like to make comments, we'll hold off until that time.
On climate adaptation?
Yeah,
he's kicking it off.
Okay.
Yeah. He's the first.
All right. At this point, then, I'd like to invite Dr. Mark Seely to come on up, and Mark is going to kick us off here with a report on climate change. Of course, anyone that listens to public radio knows of Dr. Seely's wide and diverse background. We're excited, Dr. Seely, to have you here today, and I'm always struck by your mellow, resonant voice when you're talking on public radio. Some of you who have a little gray hair will remember WCCO and the Franklin Hobbs Show, Charlie. And I'll tell you what, he played great music live from Gull Lake, if I recall, but also had this wonderful, mellow voice. And when the university work is complete, Mark, you'll have a job in radio. So
maybe I could do the all-night show.
There you could, yeah, right. By that time, climate will have changed, so the sun is shining all night maybe. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I assume that I'm okay here and that you'll be viewing the visuals I'm going to show you. I've already been asked this, so I'll leave it with a simple statement. The winner of the game Saturday at TCF Stadium will be the team that can handle a frozen football the best. So,
The Gophers.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I've been your extension climatologist for 36 years at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus. We are caretakers of your state database along with your Minnesota State Climate Office. And as such, we feel it's a valuable resource to the state of Minnesota. Most of my reference in my remarks will be based on our state database and what it's showing. So with that, I'd like to go through here. Well, maybe I'm going to have to use the keypad here.
Mark?
Yeah.
This closer, that's good.
Oh, okay. But I was thinking of it.
There you go.
Well, oh, while they're working
okay,
on
there
that,
we go.
You can all sign up for the Affordable Health Care Act.
Oh, okay. Right. There was a...
More than usual.
I've broken this into three segments to talk about Minnesota's changing climate features. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I am going to talk about the more important ones. Talk about the consequences of those changing features, and then comment on extremes. I did want to highlight for those of you that missed it, earlier this month in Science Magazine, for those of you that read Science Magazine, you probably didn't miss Richard Moss's article about the need for climate adaptation. I thought it was very effective. It was based on his presentation at the Aspen Institute a year or so ago, that science for adaptation starts with understanding decision-making processes and information needs, determining where the vulnerabilities are, and then moves to climate trend analysis, climate modeling, and tracks whether adaptation is effective. I am familiar from my national colleagues that this is a theme that resonates with most of our states, and so they are moving forward in this direction. I'm not getting anywhere with this. I'll just use the keypad here.
Okay,
the three features I'm going to talk about are our changing temperatures, our changing water vapor, as we commonly call dew points, and our changing moisture variability in the state. By the way, my remarks, just for clarification, a lot of my remarks are based not simply on statistical quantity changes, okay? That's, of course, what we commonly look at in science. But some of my remarks are on what I call character changes, the nature of the climate attribute and how it occurs. Here's a depiction of the statewide climate database for temperature, expressed as our mean annual state temperature from all observations back to the late 19th century. It simply shows, like so many surrounding states here in the upper Midwest, there's an upward trend. There's an upward trend depicted by the purple line, dashed line through the middle. Note, please, also that on the far right side, the dashed blue line shows an even steeper upward trend that has been occurring in the last three decades. And the top line, the faint red line at the top, is the historic 90th percentile of all mean annual temperatures in the state database. And you will note that we have several recent years that exceeded the 90th percentile in terms of that temperature. The seasonality character of temperature is important because it has effects. It has effects on the physical environment as well as the biological environment. The seasonality character analysis of Minnesota's changing temperatures shows that it is more persistent and amplified in the winter season. In terms of temperature change, it is more persistent and more amplified in the winter season than the other seasons of the year. That's not to deny that the climates are warming in the other seasons of the year, but just not as emphatically as in the winter season. I would remind you, as all citizen members, that in recent winters we've had temperature departures in the month of January that have been 35 degrees above normal. Not simply 5 or 10 degrees warmer than normal, but as much as 35 degrees above normal. Background averages are changing. Minimum temperature at the nation's ice box, International Falls, is changing significantly. Their winters are shortening, and they don't have the extremes that they once had. You can see they've been changing by whole degrees as we step through the decades. In terms of their average monthly minimum temperatures. This is true for many locations in Minnesota. Across-the-board changes are evident as we look at the new normals. We deployed the new state normals as mandated by law to transfer from the 1971 to 2000 record period for a describing frame of reference for all our Minnesota communities. So we now use 1981 to 2010. When we made that transition, it begged the question, how are we changing the normals? In which direction are we changing the normals? And emphatically, we changed most of the normals in the positive direction. That is, we raised the floor of what we call average for most months, and we raised it more emphatically for average minimum temperature than maximum temperature. But nevertheless, the magnitude of those changes is depicted in this chart for a location like Willmar. On our website, you can access similar data for any one of about 250 communities in the state of Minnesota. As a result of these changing attributes of temperature, we see physical and biological consequence. Our state agency partners in the work that we do, as well as our federal agency partners in the work that we do, and also our University of Minnesota research partners have increasingly, with each passing year, documented consequences of these changing temperatures. We now know lakes and soils are frozen for less calendar days than they once were. We know that farmers are witnessing the breakdown of crop residues in their fields at a faster pace than what they formerly did. We have delayed application of fall nitrogen in our soils where that practice is done because the soils remain warm too deep into the fall season. We've got change in plant hardiness zones. So the Minnesota Landscape and Nurserymen's Association, as many of you who are gardeners are probably well aware, they can market plant species for zone 4 and zone 5A more widely across the Minnesota geography. We have biological consequence. More and more we hear about this in terms of organisms that once suffered high mortality in our winters are surviving our winters and reappearing on the Minnesota landscape in earlier spring dates. We have reduced heating degree days, a silver lining, if you will, for our pocketbooks, because our heating seasons don't quite demand the energy use for heating that they once did. In fact, 12 of the last 16 heating seasons have been remarkably warm. We've got increased freeze-thaw cycles so that we're flirting with a 32-degree isotherm more commonly in Minnesota, and this is creating problems for managing our roads and highways. We have wildlife impacts due to the changing nature of our temperature as well. Some bird species no longer migrate out of the state, and we also see changing patterns in wildlife habit. And then public health sector, which you're going to hear more about later, we have longer exposure times to molds and allergens, so many of our public health care facilities have had to adjust to this. The water vapor signal is an episodic one. It's nevertheless one that we feel profoundly when our dew points get above 70 degrees. There's not a person in the room today that doesn't feel discomfort when the dew point gets above 70. That is, by definition, a tropical air mass in meteorology. That's one of the criteria we use to define a tropical air mass. Both here in the Twin Cities, as the graphic at the top, as well as up at Voyageurs National Park on the Canadian border, the graphic at the bottom, show that we have had numerous episodes in recent decades of tropical-like air invade our state. The most immediate consequence of that is to inflate the heat index. It makes the everyday summer temperature of 85 or 90 degrees feel like 105 or 110. And so commonly now the Weather Service is having to issue more frequent heat advisories and excessive heat warnings. In fact, if we pass the modern definition of a heat advisory back through Minnesota's historic database, we can find no period in our state's history where the Weather Service has had to issue this type of information to the public. And it's all driven by the high dew points. The number at the bottom, I just want to give a quick caveat. The 134-degree heat index that was observed at Moorhead, Minnesota, on July 19, 2011, is a real number. And by the way, it's been certified by the National Weather Service as the North American record for the highest heat index ever measured in North America. So we are now proud holders of the coldest Groundhog's Day ever measured in the U.S., February 2nd, 1996, with minus 60 at Tower, and the hottest heat index ever measured in the USA, July 19th, 2011. The heat index is the marker we use now to declare heat waves in Minnesota. That is the declaration of a heat wave. All the red marked years here are years where we have had heat waves due to high dew points, not because the thermometer went to 110 or 112 as it once did historically, but because the heat index is so high. Some consequence that's been documented for the effect of these high dew points is a biological one. Some organisms love high dew points, and they, in fact, have more generations of the same species in one summer than they once did. We see changes in aquatic habitats. We've opened the new Aquatic Research Center at the University of Minnesota, partly due to this phenomena. We have increased workload in the public health care sector, increased stress on our agricultural livestock sector, where it's actually realized some pretty significant mortality from these heat waves. We have adjustments in our school systems. Notably, we don't have to even go back but a few months to realize how we started the school year this year with environmental conditions not conducive to teaching young students when the heat index is 105. And then we have increased demand for air conditioning. Lastly, our precipitation amplitude and variability has changed. It's generally gone up. The quantities have generally gone up. We do note that historically 2010 was the wettest year in state history. We see changes in our normals as we go community to community. The changes in our normals may vary from only an upward trend of 5% to maybe an upward trend as high as 20 or 30%. But we are not only concerned about quantity changes, we're concerned about character changes. And some of them we've noted that you've probably heard me talk about. In the snow deposition season in Minnesota now, we are seeing an increasing fraction of our precipitation come as liquid rather than frozen precipitation. We're also seeing intensities of precipitation change, and especially on the extreme ends of things. We're seeing the thunderstorm occurrence of 2-, 4-, 6-inch rainfalls changing, and we're seeing seasonality shifts. One marker of this that is in really published only in the last 4 to 6 years is what the National Weather Service defines as favorable severe weather parameters. Now, in the National Weather Service jargon, they often use a numeric called the ingredients method. They actually look for ingredients, measured quantities in the upper atmosphere that are conducive to the formation of severe weather. And by that, of course, I mean severe thunderstorms, large hail, straight-line winds, tornadoes, etc. There is a detectable northern migration to higher latitude of the severe weather ingredients in this country, so that the strength of severe weather ingredients that was once confined to Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, places like that, is now of the same order of magnitude up here in the high plains, in the Dakotas, Minnesota, the Canadian provinces, etc. It doesn't mean Mother Nature pulls the trigger on severe weather all the time, but the ingredients for severe weather are migrating northward. As a result, we're measuring consequence of that. We've had 3 1,000-year flash floods in southeastern Minnesota since 2004. These are the 13, 14, 15, 17-inch rainfalls that formerly we had no record of in the Minnesota Climate Database. We now have at our disposal the new NOAA Atlas 14, which I think you're going to hear about later, which is a documentation paid for by the state, by the way, of all the modern data, all up to date, as comprehensive as possible, so that we can recalculate the statistics of the recurrence frequencies more precisely for the 4-inch rains, the 5-inch rains, the 6-inch rains. And those data are all available now to Minnesota citizens online for anywhere in the state. You can absolutely bury yourself in data if you're a hydrologic engineer, but nevertheless, these are the types of data that need to be applied today because the statistics have changed. In 2012, we had an anomaly. We call it a singularity, but given the changing nature of quantity and character of our climate, I don't think it'll remain an anomaly for too many years. And that is, we had a Minnesota landscape with widespread declaration of drought disaster. All those counties color-coded that were eligible for federal drought assistance from the federal government. And at the same moment in time, we had all those counties with crosses declared by FEMA as federal flood disasters and eligible for federal flood assistance. The first and only time in Minnesota's state history we've had the same counties declared for polar opposite natural disasters at the same moment in time. That is a marker of amplified climate variability. So lastly, the consequences of this precipitation or hydrologic change is more attention we're having to give to drainage runoff shoreline management, retrofits or redesigns of storm sewer runoff systems, as they're contemplating in Duluth right now, modified fisheries management, mitigation of soil erosion, mitigation of flood potential, and impacts on the insurance industry. Impacts on the insurance industry have been pretty prolific. I would encourage those of you that have not heard the message from Bob Johnson, president of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, I would ask you to invite him to testify before your committee sometime. Lastly, a quick comment on extremes. Up until 2010, Minnesota had never led the nation in tornadoes, but we did so in 2010 with 113 documented tornadoes, 48 on one day in June. Our neighbors, which we're increasingly collaborating with in the north, in the provinces of Ontario and Manitoba, are likewise concerned about this because Canada reported its first ever F5 tornado back in 2007, which is an order of convective energy that they formerly never measured in Canada. And even up on the tundra of Hudson Bay in 2010, they had their first ever 4-inch thunderstorm rain fall on the permafrost landscape of Hudson Bay, something previously totally undocumented. So I'm going to stop there because of time, but I wanted to emphasize my bottom line to you is for contemplation of your duties and responsibilities with respect to Minnesota citizenry, I think it's important for all of us to look at what our state database is telling us. Our state database is telling us a lot about what's happening to our climate, and I think that we need to pay attention to it and give a lot of consideration to both adaptation and mitigation relative to this changing climate. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. Can you explain last weekend's crazy weather across the Midwest?
Well, the
thunderstorms and
the tornado and severe thunderstorms of Sunday was not without precedent. It falls in the top five historically for so late in the season. There were at least 81 tornado reports and about 57 reports of hail, and of course that ignores all the straight line winds as well. It has occurred historically, but it's rare. But the episode that occurred on Sunday does fall in the historic top five. I don't know that it's going to be years down the road before we can take any of these extreme occurrences and episodes and actually document what fraction of their attribution can we pin on climate change. Research-wise, we're not there yet, but we do suspect that there's an association.
Thanks. Questions?
Just to follow up, if you would comment, the National Weather Service did have alerts go out, and if you would comment on the cell phone usage that they did there and the low count and number of injuries and deaths that happened.
Yes, the National Weather Service has really in the last, at least in our lifetime and most notably the last 10 years, really tried to use all the modern technology to better serve the public with their watch and warning scheme on severe weather elements. So phone apps, for example, mobile apps are continuously being devised, and we're going to be getting more and more of those deployed nationwide. So we won't have any landscape in our country where the public will not be able to get some kind of a watch or warning for severe weather. And that's going to save a lot of people's lives. They've really made huge progress in that area, and NOAA's dedicated themselves to continuing to do that.
Other questions for Dr. Seeley?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. John Lichtstein?
Not a question, but just I'd be interested, Dr. Seeley, in your take, maybe this is a question, about Atlas 14 and the changing hydrology of the state. What do you think that, what implications that it have for state officials, for our agencies? What's your opinion on what you've seen out of Atlas 14?
First off, Atlas 14, for those of you that want to do historic comparisons, the methodology applied to Atlas 14 is a different methodology than that used historically. So we have to recognize that that's going to infer some differences statistically. But based on the raw numbers that went into NOAA Atlas 14, there are some different distributions and extremes involved in the analysis now. Not uniformly across the state. In fact, we have disparity in the data sets across the state. So that's somewhat reflected in the new numbers. A lot of the new numbers are up. They're elevated. The quantities we look at, for example, for the 5-minute interval, the 1-hour interval, the 24-hour, 2-year interval, et cetera, are up by varying magnitudes. Some are relatively small changes and some are large changes. It's the best data we have available for hydrologic design considerations at the moment. And I think the other marker of using NOAA Atlas 14 that's going to be helpful is when we consider what kind of a hydrologic situation can we mitigate, it might provide us a ceiling. It might provide us a better context for us. For example, they talked about this with respect to the city of Duluth, John, recently, so that if you look at the price tag to redesign a storm sewer runoff system for a 10-inch rainfall, your city cannot afford it. But if you want to scale down and maybe try to cope with the 50-year or some other recurrence interval, then maybe it's more plausible. So I think it's giving good context for our citizen groups and our local units of government to better look at what are their boundaries and within those boundaries, what can they do? And using all the modern data, every piece of data we had in the Minnesota State Database went into this. I think it's the best tool we have now to work with.
Thank you.
For those of you that are looking at the back of Dr. Seeley's head, I want to inform you how excited he gets when talking about data. It's just like, yes!
Please, I will exhibit the same excitement at my granddaughter's 6th birthday today.
Good. Dr. Seeley.
Dr. Seeley, thanks for the presentation. And I at the joke about data. Just confirming everything you presented here today, none of it's modeling. All of it is looking at data and things that we've experienced as a state. That's correct?
That's correct, Kate. And the scary thing about that is all of this is evidence that provokes us to action just based on data. Now, the problem is that when we look at models, some of the pace of change depicted in our data is expected to accelerate. So we think we're undertaking a task here where we see a pace of change that's startling in our data. But when we start to look at some of the climate models, it even amplifies that pace of change. And that's very disconcerting to us.
More?
No, thank you.
When you're talking about models, I'm reminded of the great Professor Ball from Wisconsin who said, all models are wrong, however, some are useful.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Dr. Seeley, I'm just curious. You talked about the 10-inch rain up in Duluth, and I experienced that, or the aftermath of it. You also mentioned a couple of times that we've experienced 3,000-year events in the last decade. Is there an anticipation that we're going to change the terminology of 100-year event, 50-year event, 1,000-year event? Because right now, if we're planning something that's a 100-year event, evidently what you're saying is that may be more of a 10-year event now.
Well, I think what the National Weather Service is sensitized to now is that the nature of our hydrologic database has to be reexamined more frequently than every 50 years. The pace of change that's going on, especially with these convective storms. And those of you that have read my book on the Minnesota Weather Almanac know that I document in my book a storm in July of 1867 that deposited 30 inches on the Minnesota landscape. Now, Mother Nature's capable of doing that. In fact, arguably, Mother Nature, if you look at the hydrologic potential for our latitude region of the North American continent, we can get up to 35 inches of rain under the right circumstances. But so we need to relook at the data we're using more frequently than every 50 years. The pace of change that's going on has really got the attention of the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So I think these statistics are going to be revisited across time. We are loath to take model output projections of precipitation, especially for local scale applications, and incorporate them into these types of decisions, because when we look at the modeled output of precipitation scenarios for the future, it's all over the place. It has a much wider error range with it than what we look at for temperatures. So that makes us nervous about trying to apply models to better look at this. But I think we're going to have to revisit the data more frequently.
Other comments or questions while we have Dr. Seeley here? Thank you so much.
Thanks for your kind attention. And I'll be here to address any clarifications later as we step through this agenda.
All right. Thank you very much.
And have fun at your granddaughter's birthday party.
Thank you. All right. I think we'll continue then with our agency presentations for the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team. And we're going to start with Jim.
Hi, I'm Paul Moss with MPCA, and I just wanted to provide a little of the initial context for the agency presentations, if I might, beforehand.
I'm sorry, Paul. Yeah, I just flew right by.
No, that's okay. I think that it'll provide a little bit more context for what the agencies will be discussing. So again, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Appreciate it. I'm Paul Moss from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And in the next hour and a half or so, we'll be going through a number of agency presentations from the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team, as well as some opportunities for interagency action, which are identified on the report which you received, and then have some additional time for continuing discussion. Just before we launch into that, I just wanted to give a little bit of background on adaptation and mitigation, some of the terminology that we're using. Although I know that you're familiar with this, essentially, adaptation are kind of strategies and initiatives and measures that help human and natural systems address impacts. It's not focusing necessarily on reducing climate change or the magnitude of progression of climate change. That would be considered to be mitigation. Just to show again how adaptation and mitigation kind of relate to each other, adaptation can be, again, is focused again on impacts, on risk management, and often the kind of responses that we would implement for climate adaptation would be more on the local level or the state or regional level, whereas for mitigation, when we're looking at trying to achieve greenhouse gas reductions overall for the planet, we're focusing on some of these global economic and environmental systems. So when looking at energy issues and energy efficiency, so just to kind of show, but there is actually a kind of an intersection between actions that are helpful for adaptation as well as mitigation. And those might be things like urban trees or cool roofs, different types of building practices, water conservation. So there's actually some ways that we can achieve multiple goals. And we'll be talking more about multiple goals, and you'll hear that from agencies as well. Just in terms of the complementarity of mitigation and adaptation, this is a quote from the National Climate Assessment, which if you may have seen it, it's an excellent summary of what is going on right now with our climate in the United States. And it just indicates that both adaptation and mitigation are needed to address the challenges that we're facing. So in terms of Minnesota, and in a little context for the presentations that you'll be hearing from the different agencies, the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team started in 2009. It consists of currently 9 agencies listed here, and it was actually initiated by the agencies themselves. It was not a requirement or mandate from the legislature. They did put out a report, a preliminary report in 2010, and recently this year, they updated that report, and I believe you've received that in your packets, and there were a few copies over here for those that didn't receive that in the audience. The ICAT also presented to the 2013 legislature to a joint committee hearing between several House committees in January of 2013, and we've worked hard this year to identify agency collaboration opportunities and information sharing and et cetera. We've also helped with a number of the members of the committee helped with a large statewide climate adaptation conference recently at the Science Museum on November 7th. In the report that you received, you note that it describes these climate change trends that affect Minnesota, characterizing impacts, and provides an excellent summary of activities by agencies. So although that what you'll hear right now from the different agencies will be a summary of what they've reported in that document, and so it's a great resource for looking at to get more information about what the agencies are doing, and kind of underscores the importance of this issue. Just a couple slides, again, to note that we're not the only state that's working on climate adaptation. This chart shows the states that are either have the blue states are those that have adaptation plans complete. Those that are purple are recommending adaptation efforts in their climate adaptation plans, and we're one of the states that is in green and that it's considered to be a plan in progress, probably because of that 2010 report, which has recently been updated with what you've received. So you notice that a lot of the states are on the coasts, and that's because sea level rise is one of the most important impacts of climate change and has huge cost implications. And so the states that are on the coast tend to have made more focus on climate adaptation than the states internally in the country. There's a document, I just have a link here if people want more detail about what some of these states are doing, at least as of 2012. This document from Natural Resources Defense Council provides some very detailed information on that. And just to note, our neighbors to the east in Wisconsin have a very interesting website as well as a report about climate impacts in their state, which is a useful reference. So with that, let's move to the first of nine presentations by state agency representatives. Again, we'll have about, the plan was to have each agency do approximately three slides in about 5 minutes, and we'll try and keep to that schedule if we can. So the first would be Jim Manolis from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Thanks for the opportunity to share DNR's perspective on climate change with you today. My name is, as mentioned, Jim Manolis, and I coordinate DNR's Climate Change and Renewable Energy Steering Team. So climate change has been really a rising concern for DNR over the past decade or so. And, you know, we're frankly quite alarmed with what we're seeing. Our staff are often the first responders to weather-related disasters and first observers of more subtle changes in habitats and species. We've seen tremendous and costly impacts from the floods that Dr. Seeley mentioned, from fires, from the large fires we've seen in northeastern Minnesota in particular, and some of these large blowdowns. And you know, as Dr. Seeley mentioned, we've got good evidence that the risks for these events are on the rise. We don't have time to go into the details of these, but you know, they're significant impacts that we're seeing and see those risks in the future. So we're also beginning to see impacts on habitats and species. One experience I remember well is being up in northwestern Minnesota, standing on the edge of the forest with a forester, and he was showing me a field of shriveled black jack pine seedlings, and he was telling me about how he had been planting these repeatedly, and the forest wasn't growing, and we were seeing invasive species thriving in that place. And so that really struck me. And what he said, he thought in there we really need to lower expectations for growing forests in that region. And what it implies, on the lower left of the graphic, you know, what he may have been seeing was an early sign of a projected shift in the prairie forest border in Minnesota. And Dr. Frelick at the university talks about this shift, and he suggests it might go as far as 300 miles to the northeast in Minnesota, that really we're going to be more of a prairie state than a forest state. Now, we don't know for sure how far that shift is going to go. There's a lot of uncertainties of this, but we know it's going to go. We're quite sure it's going to go part way, and the character of our forests is going to change. And we also expect to see substantial changes in our wetlands, in our lakes and rivers, and the species that inhabit them. One example is this fish, the cisco. It's a cold water fish. It's actually quite common. People don't see them very often because they don't bite. We've seen a 42% decline in this species since the 1970s. And this species really requires the deep cold water, rich oxygenated water that tends to decrease as the water is warm. And we see some dramatic fish kills sometimes during these heat waves in the summer. So that's an example of climate change affecting a species. Next slide. Okay. So what are we doing about this? We really have been trying to do a number of things, especially over the past 4 years. And we really are wanting to build resilience to this kind of change. We've taken numerous steps to build capacity. We've developed and established climate change teams, climate and renewable energy steering team, and four sub-teams. One of those teams focuses on climate change adaptation. And that team and the other teams have worked really hard at putting together foundational information. One example is what we call our foundations document. It's about an 80-page report that we put out in 2011, and it's really a primer for staff to look at climate change science and also a potential adaptation and mitigation strategies. Following on that, we developed a number of adaptation strategies over a period of time, and then just this fall convened four regional workshops involving about 200 staff in engaging in adaptation strategies. So we feel like we're making some good progress in building capacity, but we're also taking action, and this comes in the form of planning, where we have integrated climate change at a strategic planning level, but also at regional forest plan level to site, like state plan type levels. We also have increasingly getting it into a biennial work plan level. Also, we've taken a number of landscape and watershed projects where one example is our multi-prairie conservation plan that has a climate change component. We also have, our ongoing flood mitigation efforts are important efforts to develop resilience to climate change. And a number of site projects as well, and monitoring is a key thing that we do through the climatology office, but also a range of monitoring efforts throughout the department. One of them is really focused on climate change monitoring, and that's called our Sustaining Lakes and Changing Environment Program, also known as SLICE. So, we still have a lot to do, however. We've gotten a good start in building a foundation, but we do see climate change as one of the greatest challenges our agency has faced. And so we have a lot to do. We need to accelerate efforts to conserve and restore the quality, the size, and the connectivity of Minnesota's natural lands and waters. And this is the kind of work that we have done in the past, and we need to continue to do and accelerate to build the health and resilience into the system so that they can adapt to climate change more effectively. And we also need to integrate adaptation strategies more broadly into our planning and on-the-ground management. We have a number of innovators and early adopters that have been doing things, but we need to do a more systematic and comprehensive job. And, of course, climate change is an issue that one agency can't address alone. We really need to expand our partnerships and collaborations. The ICAT has been a good example, but we need a lot more collaboration, especially at a local level. And finally, with monitoring, as I mentioned, we do a lot of monitoring. We need to bolster monitoring, especially at the level of integrating and analyzing data quickly enough so that we can respond to changing conditions as the climate changes. So thank you, and look forward to questions.
Thanks, Jim. If you have questions, please holler. Questions for Jim?
All right. Thanks very much, Jim. The next member of the interagency team is Kristen Robb. She'll be presenting from the Minnesota Department of Health.
Hi, Kristen. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you to the board members. Again, my name is Kristen Robb. I'm the Minnesota Climate and Health Program Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. And before I begin, I'd like to thank PCA for their leadership and the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team. This is a diagram that shows the linkages between climate changes and health-related outcomes. Minnesota is experiencing several changes in climate that the health department's very concerned about, and Mark Seeley talked a lot about these, but I'm going to highlight a few of them for you today. First, we are concerned about the increasing in temperature. Since 1970, Minnesota is the third fastest warming state in the continental United States. It's not just the average increasing temperature that we're concerned about, but that we're predicted to see more extreme heat events. Preliminary data from the National Weather Service for 2012 suggests that out of all the weather-related fatalities, extreme heat had the most fatalities in 2012 and has the highest 10-year average. Deaths represent only the smallest proportion of the health burden from heat. And in 2011, here in Minnesota, that's the latest data we have available, there were 1,255 emergency department visits due to heat-related illnesses and 3 deaths. Warmer temperatures are increasing the pollen production and allergy season, which some of you are probably suffering from. From 1995 to 2011, Minneapolis has experienced a 21-day increase in the length of the ragweed pollen season. We're also concerned about increasing humidity, which decreases the air temperature necessary to have human health impacts. Dr. Seeley also spoke about that. Since 1977, all the heat events in Minnesota were driven by high humidity except one. We're also obviously very concerned about the change in the character and quantity of precipitation. The frequency of 3 inches or more storm events has increased 104% since 1961 to 2011. Increased heavy precipitation can lead to flooding, which causes injuries, infrastructure damage, mental health issues, and displacement, and can lead to recreation and drinking water contamination. So we're very concerned about these climate changes and their impacts on public health. We don't know how many events will occur every year. We don't know how severe those events will be. And we don't know if we'll have multiple events, such as a tornado that swept through northern Minneapolis in 2011 and then afterwards suffered from a heat wave. We expect that all of these things will increase in frequency. So in order to prepare public health and the public for climate change, MDH has supported activities in 5 critical areas. I'm just going to highlight a few of those activities in each of these areas. Under education and communication, MDH has created a very popular website that contains all of the products that we've developed thus far. We also have a listserv with over 700 followers. The program, the Minnesota Climate and Health Program, has developed 6 training modules that are accessible to the public and also to local public health. They are Climate Change 101 and Health, Water Quality and Quantity, Air Quality, Extreme Heat, Mental Health, and Agriculture and Food Security. All of the modules have been very popular. Our 2 most popular are Heat and Water, and they've had over 1,300 hits. Under Planning and Technical Assistance, we've developed the Minnesota Extreme Heat Toolkit, which contains almost everything, emergency planners, or local public health practitioners need to develop a heat response plan. Before the development of the toolkit, only two jurisdictions in Minnesota had a heat response plan or an annex to their all hazards plan, but now five jurisdictions have plans and they cover a substantial portion of the Minnesota population. We've also been working very closely with local public health to provide GIS mapping services to help identify vulnerable populations to help their districts plan for climate change. Several programs at MDH are involved in tracking diseases and conditions that are influenced by climate change. The Minnesota Environmental Public Health Tracking Program posts data available to the public on diseases and conditions that are affected by climate change, such as asthma, drinking water quality, and heat-related illnesses. The Vector-Borne Disease Program has detected a spread in the geographic distribution of tick-borne diseases and an increase in the number of median cases for tick-borne diseases. There were 1,050 reported from 2004 to 2012, comparing that to the median of 373 from 1996 through 2003. So we're seeing increases in vector-borne diseases, and we're seeing them spread. Related to policy development, the Minnesota Climate and Health Program reviewed 53 comprehensive plans submitted to the Metropolitan Council in 2008 to see if our local, the metropolitan seven-county area jurisdictions are planning for climate change and public health. Out of the 53 that we reviewed, only 13 even mentioned climate change, and only 11 mentioned greenhouse gases. We shared this information with the Metropolitan Council and have applauded their efforts to incorporate climate changes in their latest planning framework, which is Thrive MSP 2040. I'd also like to remind the AQB that we came before them in September 2012 to discuss ways the environmental assessment worksheet could be improved to include climate change-related questions. As far as collaboration, the Office of Emergency Preparedness designs and implements exercises with partners to ensure that Minnesota communities are prepared for weather-related disasters. And the Drinking Water Protection Program works with Minnesota public water suppliers to ensure that our drinking water is safe from storms. We have several next steps and some challenges. I won't review all of them. Under planning and technical assistance, I did want to make the board aware that we are developing a Minnesota climate and health profile, which will assemble all that we know to date about climate changes and its impacts in public health, which will be released in spring of 2014. We're also compiling a vulnerability report on counties with higher vulnerable populations and counties that have had historically more severe weather events. This report will also be released in the spring, and it is our hope that these tools will help generate more conversation about the need to plan for climate change and serve as a valuable resource to our partners. In regards to research, MDH will be exploring heat and humidity thresholds that correspond with health outcomes, such as increased emergency room visits related to heat. We want to make sure that the National Weather Service warnings are adequate to prevent illnesses and deaths from heat. A challenge to us in this area is that we do not have real-time data on heat-related illnesses, so we are unable to provide situational awareness to local public health departments and responders. We will continue to review policies for their implications on climate change and health. For collaboration, the program has entered into a dialogue with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, North Dakota, Health Canada, and Manitoba Health to promote cross-border collaboration in planning for weather-related disasters. And we look forward to continue to work with local agencies and other state agencies to prevent the negative health impact of climate change.
Kristen, thank you very much. Any questions? Commissioner Ellinger.
Kristen, one of the issues that we all have to deal with is disparities, and I think the other agencies will also have an impact on vulnerable populations. Are there specific vulnerable populations that we need to be concerned about related to climate change?
That's a very good question, and it's a hard one to answer in that it really depends on what the event, weather event that we're looking at, because in certain cases, those that are vulnerable to flood might be people living in low-lying areas or other people. But for extreme heat, for example, it might be elderly living alone. It might be people that do not have air conditioning or can't afford to turn on their air conditioning. So vulnerabilities actually vary depending on what the actual weather event is. But it is something that we're looking at. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much. Paul?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The next presenter will be from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Assistant Commissioner Matt Wallman.
Welcome, Matt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the EQB. Thanks for the opportunity to join you today to as you review the issue of climate change. I'm Matt Warman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, also a fifth-generation farmer. Weather and climate are critical to a strong agricultural economy in the state. Our crop and livestock production is impacted by weather every single day. Whether it's wet or dry, hot or cold, or whether we face volatile weather patterns that include hail, wind, floods, or drought. To say the least, agriculture is highly dependent on favorable weather and climate. In recent years, we have been experiencing increasing temperatures and extreme heat. As a result, we have witnessed crop production areas that have shifted in the state. Mr. Chairman, I know that you can remember a time when corn and soybeans weren't as prevalent in northern Minnesota. And in the last few decades, these crops have... not a problem.
I remember
thank
when
you.
It wasn't corn.
See, we have reviews coming up, don't we?
In the last few decades, corn and soybeans have become common in areas of the Red River Valley and North Dakota and South Dakota, et cetera. We've also seen longer growing seasons, and according to the National Climate Assessment, the Midwest growing season has lengthened by almost 2 weeks since 1950. While increased growing degree days may increase crop yields, we also experience greater volatility in terms of rainfall and heat and weather events. Last year, in many parts of the country, and including here in Minnesota, we faced one of the worst droughts since the Dust Bowl era. Drought obviously has many impacts, but in particular, it impacts the quality and quantity of crop yields. It also has impacts on soil health and places additional pressures on farmers to find other ways to mitigate risk. Some of these mitigations include increasing demand for irrigation, which puts additional pressure on already strained aquifers. Minnesota is already facing the impacts of climate change. In 2007 and 2009, as you guys will recall, in southeastern Minnesota, we faced one of the most severe droughts or floods in recent memory, as Dr. Seeley mentioned. We also last year had the rainfall incidents in Duluth and south of the metropolitan area. In all of these events, we saw major impacts to Minnesota farms, infrastructure, and local communities. And not only do these have a huge economic cost in terms of the damage, but the damage quickly overwhelms that of local capacity and requires a response by state and federal disaster assistance agencies. The changing climate has also impacted agriculture in other ways. Due to a changing climate as well as globalization of our markets, Minnesota farmers are facing new endemic and exotic pests, weeds, and diseases that impact our crops and livestock sectors. Many weeds, pests, and fungi thrive under warmer weather and temperature, wetter conditions, and increased carbon dioxide. Specifically, there are threats from invasive species such as emerald ash borer and gypsy moth that have required a significant response from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. While climate change may present an opportunity in Minnesota in the longer growing seasons, could potentially increase productivity in some regions, heavier precipitation can lead to delayed planting dates, which we saw earlier this year in southeastern Minnesota, and a greater threat for runoff. Changing seasons may also require different plant varieties, and climate change will amplify the effects of existing disturbances, including the invasive species, insects, pests, and diseases. In addition to our response on invasive species and mitigation of new plant diseases, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is encouraging producers to implement best management practices for conservation, sustainable use of water and soil resources, and fertilizer and pesticide use. Again, this program, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, our Ag Water Quality Certification Program, is designed to help reduce risk and help producers to adopt these new best management practices. The adoption of best management practices could help us reduce climate change impacts of water runoff, sediment, help maintain healthier soils, and minimize pests. The department has supported the demonstration of sustainable agricultural practices. The MDA has an energy and sustainable agriculture program that offers competitive grants, which are awarded to individuals and groups for on-farm sustainable agriculture research and demonstration projects in Minnesota. We also provide assistance related to extreme weather events and helping farmers to respond to them by offering financial assistance to help with losses incurred by flooding. The department also works to help promote an all-hazards preparedness for rural communities, and we have a livestock investment grant that is focused on helping producers to invest in new equipment such as sprinkler systems and fans to address new temperature conditions. Preventing the spread and increasing awareness of pests and invasive species is a major priority for Minnesota farmers and the department, and the mission of the department's Pest Detection and Response Unit is to prevent new pests from arriving in Minnesota and establishing in our crop areas and so forth. With a focus on pests that could arrive, could harm, we're focused primarily on pests that could harm our terrestrial plants and crops. And these efforts include prevention, early detection, and rapid response. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Matt. Are there questions for Matt here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, I have a question. I think it was maybe 2 years ago now. Department of Ag entered the program with the EPA and U.S. Department mm-hmm. of Ag. Mm-hmm. Is that the Water Quality Certified Farmer Program?
Correct. I'll let Matt.
The Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, yes.
Okay. I was curious what kind of response that was receiving and
well, we are currently in the process of implementing that program, and the legislature passed language this last legislative session and appropriated $3 million, which partnered with the federal money that was dedicated to Minnesota in the tune of $6.5 million. And the department is currently working in the four pilot watershed areas that were identified by the governor and the secretary earlier this year. And we are very close to having our first certified farms in each of those areas.
And we get as excited about that as Dr. Seeley gets about data. So we're ready to go here.
Thanks.
John, did you?
No. Okay.
Thanks, Matt.
Great, thank you. I'll step back into my MPCA role. Anyway, again, really appreciate the fact that we were invited here today to present this. I think you can see that the interagency climate adaptation team is consists of a number of people that are doing some and agencies that are doing impressive work, and we're taking this whole climate adaptation issue seriously. For MPCA perspective, some of the impacts that we're seeing are excessive stormwater runoff from some of the extreme precipitation events. Untreated wastewater is also bypassing treatment plants. And again, with these floods, it's causing problems with that. We see degraded air and water quality, degraded air quality from anything from wildfires, from drought, and also because of the heat impacts on generation of ozone as well. Water quality is affected by runoff and pollutants that are suspended in runoff, and also we're seeing increase in algae and other types of organisms because of the warmer water temperatures. Large spikes in storm debris accompany these floods and storms, and are also pose a challenge. In terms of some of the actions and steps taken by the MPCA, the MPCA has developed these minimal impact design standards, MIDS, and MIDS are helpful in terms of better in treating water on site using low impact design and volume control best practices. Also in the new MS4 general permit, standing for Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System, these are permits for public entities. We were able to use these to help address problems of erosion and water pollution that are associated with heavy precipitation events. The MPCA has partnered with the Minnesota DNR and others in terms of using the many advantages of trees for climate adaptation. Trees are able to help to reduce heat. They can absorb water from storm events. They can help to clean water from that would be polluted. They can help to take off air pollutants. And so we've been looking for ways to integrate urban trees into our work. And just to mention two specific programs, the Minnesota Green Step Cities Program, which you'll be hearing from later this afternoon, has within their best practices a number of actions related to climate adaptation. And the Minnesota Green Corps Program, coordinated by MPCA, and also we've also partnered with several other agencies, including the Department of Agriculture, Health, and the DNR on that. And basically, we are placing these AmeriCorps members at sites throughout the state of Minnesota where they're working on projects that have to do with anything from stormwater best practices, urban trees, and other aspects of activities that can help to promote climate adaptation. In terms of where we see some opportunities, there's an opportunity to involve residents more in adaptation efforts. There's things that individuals can do, anything from water conservation to stormwater best practices, such as rain gardens or rain barrels, using trees around their homes, having lighter colored roofs. There's things that individuals can do also to help to adapt to climate change, and we're interested in promoting that. Working with local units of government through technical and financial assistance, we feel that the local governments are key partners in our work, further working to reduce non-point sources of air pollution. And recently, the MPCA has set up an internal climate adaptation team to better integrate climate adaptation into our work as an agency.
Thanks, Paul. Questions for Paul?
Mr.
Stein?
Just noticing, and this is not a question really, Paul, it's just an observation for the team that everybody needs to work with local partners, right? So it strikes me that one of the things we should discuss as a board and that the team should discuss is how effective efforts are at coordinating with local units of government so we don't reach out in disparate ways, but we reach out in a coordinated fashion.
Thank you.
Yeah, good point. Okay.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Okay.
Why don't you roll ahead?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Next will be Bill Grant from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, Deputy Commissioner.
Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Very good. I think people probably know the Department of Commerce most when it comes to climate change for our role in climate mitigation activities, particularly in the areas of energy efficiency and renewable energy. And while it's clear we need to maintain our leadership position and extend that leadership position in the area of mitigation, we do have several activities in the area of adaptation that I'd like to review with you. One of those is maintaining our state energy emergency plan. This is something we do in coordination with Department of Public Safety, HSEM. We coordinate with energy utilities across the state on restoration of service following weather-related emergencies. And we employ consumer response teams to assist with disaster recovery out of our insurance division to make sure that people are getting proper response from their insurance companies when they have claims to file. Focusing on the energy emergency planning function, I mentioned the energy assurance plan. This is something we are required as a part of our relationship with the Federal Department of Energy to maintain, and that includes emergency exercises. And this summer we held a tabletop exercise with the Department of Public Safety to model a particular weather event and agency responses to that event. We track duration, response times, and restoration recovery from energy supply disruptions. This, of course, affects the electric utility industry primarily, but also can affect liquid fuel delivery as well. And so one of the standards that we hold utilities to is a restoration of service quality standard, and that's something that we work closely with the State Public Utilities Commission on. We monitor utility plans to assure reliability. This, again, is primarily in the area of electric utility companies who provide electric service to the state of Minnesota and its customers. And reliability is another way of saying resilience and increased resilience to weather-related emergencies. Utilities are constantly looking at ways that they can improve their resilience. And one of the ways that they have begun doing that is by increasingly going to underground transmission lines as opposed to overhead lines, particularly in areas that are frequented by heavy storms. We monitor liquid fuel supplies to assure their adequacy. Some of the other activities out of our department in the insurance division, I mentioned the consumer response teams. These distribute insurance information and work with insurance companies on claim reporting. We work very closely with the Pollution Control Agency to produce an annual report on greenhouse gas trends and where those are going here in the state. I can tell you, and I think this is a report that this body has seen as well, we have seen a slight downward trend in greenhouse gas emissions over the last several years. We're attempting to determine whether that was mostly economy-related or are there other factors at work there. Clearly, our work on energy efficiency and renewable energy is having an impact there as well. And finally, we evaluate impacts of climate change on the insurance industry and investments that they make through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Climate Change and Global Warming Group. And I'm also aware, maybe Commissioner Rothman wants to mention more about this, we have surveyed our insurance companies about work that they're doing in the area of climate change. Dr. Seeley mentioned the good work that Bob Johnson is doing in this area as well, and we've had several discussions with Mr. Johnson about coordinating our efforts to make sure that as we move forward in the area of adaptation, we're considering the insurance implications of climate change. So
thank you. Thank you, Bill. Commissioner Rothman?
Well, it just, I suppose 10 years ago, the insurance commissioners throughout the country were asked to do this, and when we started, finally, I just decided to do it ourselves. And so we've surveyed, and not only just, I suppose, the claims and all that in the disasters that we saw in the flooding and preparedness in Duluth and all that, is an interesting dynamic, but we've reached a cooperation, a level of good dialogue. And the bottom line is whether, I mean, if we have an F1, 2, or 3 doctor, even 4 or 5, what happens? Do we have the infrastructure in place to respond? And you know, we're gathering the data and working with folks to get that that information, just as another data point. So,
other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Oh, Tom?
There's an, I read an interesting article this morning. It talked about the debate going on in Congress right now about implementation of a provision that was passed, I believe, last year, 2012. I forget what the name of it was, the two authors, that is going to reduce the subsidies to those areas where there are repeated catastrophic disasters. And the pushback that they're now getting that may delay the implementation of that, which seems really short-sighted. The long-term expectation is that if you reduce the risk of individuals moving into dangerous places, they will continue to do that, and we will continue to pay society. And it kind of surprised me that I understand why there would be pushback, but the Congress would actually be sort of yielding to that pushback. You maybe know some more about that, Commissioner.
There is, there are, I suppose, a number of different things that are going on at the same time. The flood insurance program is one of them that was implemented, and it's starting to be implemented. So there's mapping. The mapping stuff that folks are looking at, including, you know, folks at your office. But the flood zones throughout the country are changing. And because of those changes, predominantly, you know, in the hurricane areas, particularly because of Sandy in Louisiana, the question and the impact on claims and the cost of the catastrophes is prompted you know, more stringent standards on underwriting for the insurance folks, which is the consequence and result is the increased prices for folks on the residential and commercial side. And because of that, they put in high standards to try to achieve those pricing. And then the natural result is the cost of doing that. So it's creating a big debate, mostly around the coastal regions. But we see it here as well, in particular because of the result of the Duluth flooding, the crop and hail damage that have occurred, and historically, what does that mean for all of us so that, you know, we're prepared in the event. And then, of course, when you don't embed the cost of living on a coastal plain or something like that, population migration and issues like that are becoming big issues in terms of all of that property damage and the price and value. So, but it's becoming a big issue politically for those states.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul.
Next is Marcy Westrick from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Hello, Marcy. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, board members. Thank you for having me. The mission of the Board of Water and Soil Resources is to work in partnership with local governments and private landowners to improve and protect the state's soil and water resources. As Dr. Seeley said, with the extreme weather events and changes in patterns, the landscape's ability to provide sustainable economic and environmental benefits may be hindered by climate change. And with over 70% of Minnesota's land area in private lands, Bowser is working to incorporate climate adaptation considerations into our programs. Bowser has and will continue to have and promote no-regret conservation efforts. Basically, we believe that a lot of the conservation efforts that we currently do are resilient into the future, and we will continue to work on those efforts. Those include wetland restorations, working on soil health, comprehensive water management, and native vegetation. These programs all play an important role in climate, because they prevent the release of carbon and methane into the atmosphere. They help sequester carbon, and they increase landscape resiliency. Going forward, we look forward to the continuation of the collaboration with all the agencies and our work with our local partners, and we will strive to continue to protect Minnesota wetlands, continue our efforts for carbon sequestrations in all parts of Minnesota, even up in the forest areas or converting marginal lands with native vegetation, and to continue the promotion of multifunctional plantings to increase landscape resiliency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Please, John.
Marcy, could you talk a little bit about no regret, what that means?
Yeah. By no regrets, we mean that regardless of what happens with the climate, that these are practices that should be put into place, that they're the right thing to do, that they decrease runoff, they help with sediment, to control sediment, and that we will not regret putting those in the future.
We meaning the landowner?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Okay. Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, a follow-up question. You mentioned working with local government units, and we've talked about applications, working with local governments, local landowners, and that sort of thing. And my question is, to what extent do you work with the other agencies that have been presenting today to kind of coordinate that, facilitate that conversation, mm-hmm. that sort of thing?
It is, I believe, something that we can continue to improve. I think in the terms of at least the water realm and with the wetlands realm, we do coordinate with Department of Natural Resources, the MPCA, the environmental agencies, Department of Ag a lot. As far as DEED and some of the economic members of the ICAT, we will look for opportunities to work with them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marcy.
Thanks. Next, I'd like to ask Marilyn Jordahl Larson from MnDOT.
Welcome, Marilyn.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. It's nice to be here this afternoon. And I have three slides to cover 12,000 miles of highway, 19,000 bridges, and almost 50,000 culverts. So I'm going to talk
about... And a few potholes tossed in for the fun.
Okay. Hey.
Careful. 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 Careful.
How to behave.
Pardon me? Oh, sorry. I didn't see that.
Yeah, they're local. They're local, yeah.
Over the last few years in the Department of Transportation, the climate change conversation has kind of moved from mitigation to adaptation, and we are starting to look closer at those items and some of the impacts that are related to the climate that Dr. Seeley has already referred to today. I'm just going to highlight a few of them. The higher frequency of more intense precip events, which was obviously evident in our 2012 flooding in our District 1 Duluth area and District 6 Rochester area. There was greater than $50 million worth of damage in the Duluth area, and that did not include the Highway 210 Jay Cook washout. So there is definitely an economic impact. The warming winters, is indicative of an increased number of freeze-thaw cycles, which is directly related to the life cycle of our pavements. The higher nighttime lows, and you have to kind of think about that, but our higher nighttime lows is really an indication of the occurrence of more icing conditions, which is directly related to roadside safety and traveler safety, and so that is another impact. Drought impacting the water levels in our waterways can impact the mitigation of the navigation of the barges, which is also another economic impact. Wildfires obviously could result in road closures with increased detour times, travel times, visibility issues, and obviously air quality issues. and as many people have alluded to today, the increased evidence of invasive species, to name just a few of the impacts. As far as our actions, MnDOT was selected by the Federal Highway Administration through a solicitation process to receive funding to conduct a climate vulnerability assessment. We are currently doing that now on a small segment of roadway in our District 1, which is Duluth, and District 6 in Rochester. We are trying to define vulnerability based on the piece of infrastructure's sensitivity, its exposure, and its adaptive capacity. And then we'll be looking at the cost effectiveness of upgrading the design standards after we've laid over the climate models to see what the projections are to determine where our most vulnerable spots are. We hope to develop a framework and a protocol that can be used and implemented statewide. We are in its baby steps right now. It's a lot to get your head around, just based on the number of pieces of infrastructure that we are responsible for. Another thing that we've done is we've dedicated $50 million of the Chapter 152 funding to address flood-prone areas, and all those projects have to be completed by fiscal year 2016. We are also looking at pervious pavement for lower volume roadways. Our bridge hydraulics office has done extensive work related to scour plans, bridge scour plans, flood management plans, as well as incorporating the Atlas 13 data that was previously mentioned into our drainage manual. We've also got a website set up that reflects that Atlas 13 data, and they support all of our designers in implementing and using that most frequent and or most recent data, current data. Updating roadside vegetation management plans is another action item that we're working on to address the invasive species. We're also researching drought-tolerant sod and seed mixtures for our roadsides, working with the DNR on some of that. We've implemented complete streets and context-sensitive solutions that hopefully will ensure safe, multimodal, and low-impact options in an effort to help build resilience right into the infrastructure. We also participate in several, almost any federal highway, ASHTO, or interagency group that has climate, air, sustainability, energy, all of them. We are present and at the table at all of those and play an active role in those. Future actions. We're going to continue to work on that climate vulnerability assessment up in District 1 and District 6. Again, that is something that we would like to eventually roll out statewide to try and wrap our head around where are our most vulnerable infrastructure assets and how can we be most responsible financially for where we invest our money and our design standards. Research efforts, again, we will continue those on the pavement design and vegetation, and those efforts are all based on, you know, climate extremes and adaptation efforts. We also were members of the Clean Air Dialogue recently and are working on implementing some best management practices for emission reductions into all of our construction, maintenance, and design and business operations, quite frankly. And we continue to support financially the stream gauge data monitoring with the USGS, and that is in an effort so that we always have the most current hydrologic data to base our designs on. And with that, that's all I've got.
Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
Are there questions or comments, Commissioner?
Sorry, but no, it's probably relevant for all of the agencies. You know, there's things that we have to do new to accommodate climate change, but I'm wondering, there may be things that we do less of as well. For instance, I don't know, plowing, road salt, you know, are there any, I don't want to call them benefits, but are there any things we do differently that will be less expensive going forward?
We were actually just talking about that here, and, you know, with higher low nighttime temperatures, we actually might have more ice less snow, more salt. So there actually might be some negative effects on our water systems with climate change.
When I'm really depressed.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Well, don't blame the messenger.
What we have to do.
And you know, we think about it. What I didn't know is, you know, 80% of the state assets, if you put the Minnesota state of Minnesota government out there, 80% of the built assets are all these highways and bridges. I mean, just a massive amount of infrastructure. And some of it, when we're doing this assessment, is we don't know. I mean, it's all these forecasts of this transportation shortfall haven't really factored in, okay, how much is climate going to affect that? Mm-hmm. So it's and then we're talking about the collaboration, counties and municipalities. That's actually where a lot of the potholes are, and I think
that's what I said.
Yeah, as you were pointing out, Mr. Chairman, and so I think kind of getting a handle on that, it's going to be daunting.
Mr. Chair, I think what we're seeing too is, as we have done and started to do in our thoughts and strategic planning, there's some businesses, like we're encouraging the insurance folks and others to in the utility industry and everybody to understand strategically what it means to their enterprises. It's an exercise the whole state and local governments, everybody needs to be thinking in terms of actually building in and anticipating the risk and uncertainty into what our plans are.
Thank you, Marilyn. Paul?
Next, I'd like to invite up Linda Henning from the Metropolitan Council.
Welcome, Linda. And I just also want to acknowledge Jason Willett, who is here from the Met Council. Welcome to both of you. I know Jason has been part of this discussion in the past, so welcome both of you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and board members. I'm very happy that Jason is here. He has been working on these issues far longer than I have, and also, as you might know, the Metropolitan Council has such breadth and depth of activities and programs that it's always difficult for one person to represent it completely, and so I'm very happy that he is here. Many of the speakers before me from the other agencies have talked about this, the impact on activities, and the Metropolitan Council feels that impact as well in its many programs and activities. So rather than go through those in great detail, if you'll allow me, what I think I'd like to do is go to the next slide to talk very specifically about some of the initiatives we have underway at the Council. Thank you. One of the other speakers today referred early on to the Thrive 2040 MSP process that was launched by the Council this year with partners and the public to fashion the region's long-range planning for ensuring that our region remains vital, prosperous, and competitive. During the public information sessions, strong interest in climate change was expressed, and this resulted in some supplemental work group sessions and presentations on the issue. In August, the Council's Committee of the Whole confirmed a proposed policy direction for climate change adaptation, mitigation, and resilience, giving guidance that we should consider its incorporation into Thrive plans and related systems and policy plans for the region. And this has the potential to have, I think, a tremendous impact on moving things forward, working in collaboration with others. The Twin Cities Water Supply Plan, developed by the Council, also working with many other agencies and local governments, includes conservation and an increase in the diversity of sources as its emphasis, both groundwater and surface water, to be better prepared for drought or storms. In the wastewater area, the Council continues to address effects of extreme wet weather through the inflow and infiltration reduction program that has been in place for several years. This has been done to reduce clear water flow into the wastewater system. 44 of 47 participating communities have completed over $100 million of improvements to the system and eliminated millions of gallons of excess flow. Also, combined sewer overflows that were once over a billion gallons a year from our system have been reduced to a total of a little over 200,000 gallons over the past 3 years. Some council facilities have implemented best practices for stormwater management and have included such things as a green roof, permeable pavers, rain gardens, stormwater ponds and retention structures. Locations have included park and ride lots and also wastewater treatment plants. Regional parks, especially during years of drought, have been increasing their capacity for snowmaking to improve the recreational use of the parks and also increase native plantings to conserve water and to decrease stormwater runoff. As far as what we see as future needs, we want to lead by example, and we want to do more of it. Grant programs or other resources to sponsor the ways in which we can collaborate and convene by sponsoring educational workshops or forums, we think are important because they have the potential to increase public and community understanding of what can be done to encourage additional collaboration and increase the number of demonstration projects in the region. One example of a grant program that I think could be very helpful is the ICAT. We worked together on an LCCMR proposal that was submitted recently that had a very strong educational component. It was submitted for consideration, but not invited to submit back, but it still is available, and we think it could be very helpful moving forward. Partnering on demonstration projects is something that we do quite a bit of at the council. The photograph that's here on this slide is shows a green roof that was installed at the Empire Wastewater Treatment Plant, which is located in the Vermilion River watershed. There were other best practices implemented at the site, and they were all done with the collaboration support of many other agencies and organizations. These improvements have been the focus of many educational presentations at the plant, including the one featured here, which invited Friends of the Mississippi River sponsored at our site and invited many members of the public and other organizations to come. These improvements that were done at the plant were also recently showcased during the annual tour of the Vermilion River watershed, which was sponsored by the Vermilion River Joint Powers Board and attended by many people from local communities as well as Dakota and Scott County. We look forward to continuing this effort and working with other agencies and communities to work on the impacts of climate change. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Linda?
I should maybe ask this before Charlie left too. Several of the agencies are involved with sort of setting standards for infrastructure like roads and bridges and culverts and so on. And it seems to me, and maybe John, your dear hydrological background, you might know this, but how are we looking forward to think of sort of movement of water and how do we adjust for infrastructure to move more water for more extreme events?
And tiles and ag. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, and I would like to come back to this in the future because I think that part of the discussion that we started with Dr. Seeley was around Atlas 14 and the fact that we see that every engineer has to decide a design criteria and standard, and that's the normal process, but there's nothing that uniformly adopts any practice or any set of sort of starting point for those design practices. And Atlas 14 is the best available hydrologic data. That's what we heard. A number of the agencies will be using Atlas 14 as they reevaluate their standards. But one of the questions that we might best evaluate as a board is how consistently are we utilizing that information, those design parameters across the systems that we mutually engage with all units of government in designing and approving and financing. That's where we could have a very significant impact as working together as a board. So I'd like to come back to that in the future when it's appropriate.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, and thanks for your participation.
Paul?
Next will be our final agency presenter, Manny Gurney from the Department of Homeland Public Safety Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management. And following Manny's presentation, I'll just go through a few of the opportunities that were identified in the report, which will resonate, I think, with some of the discussion that the board has been having.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Board Chair, and the board for inviting us here today. As the previous presenters have already described, and you guys have already seen over the past decade and previous before that, there has been an increase in frequency and intensity of severe weather. An example of Dr. Seeley had said, you know, there's been 3,000-year flooding events in the past since 2004. HSCM has observed these as well. We've had 10 presidentially declared disasters since 2010. That doesn't count non-presidentially declared disasters that have affected the state. Primarily, the disasters are due to torrential rain, flash flooding, tornadoes, droughts, ice storms with extended power outages. This affects our agency's limited resources with increased number of presidentially declared disasters throughout over time. This also really affects the limited resources of local agencies across the state to respond to these disasters. Moving forward on climate change, I should first introduce myself and say that I'm a hazard mitigation planner for the Homeland Security and Emergency Management. What we have done this year is updating our state all-hazard mitigation plan. It's a FEMA requirement for states to have these plans in order for them to receive any federally disaster declaration funding. This year, we are addressing climate change and adaptation in the plan. We've brought together a team of experts as well as the ICAT team as well to help us develop a climate change adaptation portion of our state hazard mitigation plan. This portion of the plan is not a requirement by FEMA, so we feel as though we're kind of leading the edge, and Minnesota's leading the edge on the nation on looking at climate change and how state hazard mitigation plans can address this. We're not the very furthest along in the nation, as there was another graph about Paul had shown on climate adaptation and the majority of the coastal states looking at climate adaptation. That's similar to our state hazard mitigation plan efforts. Coastal areas are much further along on their state hazard mitigation and how climate change is being addressed in it. Hazard mitigation funding typically is available to local agencies as well as state agencies after major declared disasters declared by the president. A certain percentage of the public assistance funding is available to mitigate against any future disasters. Based upon the past 10 years and previously, we're looking at the funding to go to local agencies as well as state agencies for flood-prone homes, community tornado safe rooms, retrofitting electrical power lines, and generators for critical facilities. The reason why we've been looking at these and done this kind of outreach effort is primarily because of this increase in the intensity and severity of these storms. Our community tornado safe room and our retrofit electrical power line projects, outreach efforts have been really successful in the past 9 months, primarily because the news has been really talking about tornado activity. We've been reaching out to mobile home parks throughout the state as well as school districts. These are the two of the most vulnerable populations, that you have large populations that mobile home parks, they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have a basement, as well as some schools are not tornado safe. An example might be what happened in Wadena, Minnesota in 2011 when the tornado in EF4 destroyed the school. We helped that school build a new school through the public assistance program as well as install a community safe room. We are also providing a lot of training to local agencies to develop their hazard mitigation plans, and we're hoping that in the inclusion of our climate change adaptation portion of our state hazard mitigation plans, counties will look at that as a resource to include their county climate adaptation into their local plans. That's kind of what I have for today.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Great. With that, I'll just provide a summary and conclusion of this. First, I wanted to thank the members of the team a lot for all the work that they put in, not only in terms of their what I thought were just really great presentations today and challenging to try and distill all their work into just a few minutes, but also in terms of all that they've done in terms of contributing to that report, Adapting to Climate Change in Minnesota, because that really was written by the members of the team, and I helped assemble it and make it into a one product, but a lot of that text came from all the different agencies, and I think it reflects really well on Minnesota state government and what they're doing. So with that, I want to just reference there's at the back of that report, there's a number of different opportunities that were identified for interagency and collaborative action, and this will kind of resonate with some of what you've already heard. There's seven areas there that we came up with. Some can be acted on with existing resources, and some would need additional funding or policy direction. And as it has been brought up, collaboration with local partners really is going to be key in moving forward in this area. So just going through these seven opportunity areas, the first is building resilience to extreme precipitation. One of the clearest climate signals that we heard from Dr. Seeley is that we're seeing more extreme precipitation, and the agencies are confirming that. And so there are opportunities, though, in terms of addressing some of these issues with green infrastructure, floodplain management, wetland restoration, urban forests, as well. So that's something that the agencies felt was a priority area for future collaboration. Second was trying to implement best practices that would have multiple benefits. The problem is that sometimes because there's uncertainty about the future and some of these future trends, that it leads to inaction. And what Marcy brought up from Bowser about no regrets is that there are things we can do that regardless of whatever happens with these climate trends are still will have been worthwhile. So we won't ever have regretted investing in these best practices, which are in many cases very positive things. And so some examples of those types of things are which a number of the agencies have mentioned, wetland restoration, stormwater best management practices, water conservation, white roofs, urban trees, wildfire protection planning, soil conservation. These are all best practices that will help in addressing climate challenges regardless of how they unfold. A third area that was identified was about protecting human health, recognizing that there's still gaps in our public health system. And some of the opportunities were to target climate assistance to vulnerable populations. And that's been discussed as well from Kristen in terms of it does vary in terms of what the climate parameter we're talking about, who's vulnerable. But there are many groups of vulnerable populations in our state. Evaluating climate change preparedness measures, assisting emergency managers, developing new tools and models. The fourth of those was to strengthen our existing ecosystems. As Jim pointed out, we're already facing a lot of stresses in our ecosystems in the state, and climate just acts as an amplifier. Climate change is amplifying these changes and causing them to be less resilient. Those are things like pollution, habitat loss, invasives. And so anything we can do to strengthen our existing ecosystems is going to help them to be more resilient to climate change. They can include things that would promote soil and ecological health, better integrating climate change into our natural resource management and planning. And so those are some approaches that the group felt were important. Building partnerships with local government, we also saw as a key area for interagency collaboration. And I know that's already been discussed. Local governments have very limited resources for the many functions that they have to fill and don't always have the information that they need. And so there's opportunities for the state agencies to partner with local governments on adaptation, including helping to fund efforts, technical assistance, providing information, and supporting planning efforts. There's some still, as Dr. Seeley pointed out, I mean, we do know quite a bit from the data that we have collected already, but it's still limited in terms of climate, measuring climate impacts, and especially in terms of projecting climate trends for the future. So there's opportunities for interagency research projects, including monitoring and trend analysis, cost and impact assessments, also studying vulnerability. And the final thing, but not least, is that there's a challenge in that the public and local stakeholders have not always been involved in their resource, their energy hasn't been tapped in terms of working on climate adaptation issues. And so there's some opportunities for the agencies to develop some consistent core messages for the public, case studies, campaigns across agencies to take advantage of joint training opportunities and develop toolkits. So with that, questions or discussion, please feel free to invite any of the members of that you've heard to approach.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, it is easy to sort of get depressed about all of the problems that we've seen here, but for the work of the various state agencies that are really, really involved in this, and thank you for your commitment. I really rest a whole lot easier because we are doing yo-person work as it relates to climate change.
Just to echo your words, Mr. Chair, that we should want to commend all of our staffs for the work that they've done, the collaboration and dedication to the issue. Even without encouragement, they have taken the project on and done a terrific job. You can see it in the results and laid their foundation very well for a lot of what we're doing, and some of it is even more than what's on the slides, and it goes deeper. So we should acknowledge that and thank them. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? If not, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're at a point where we could really segue nicely into the Green Step Cities program, but before we go there, I think we want to ask Ellen, Senior Advisor to the Governor, to come forward, Ellen Anderson, to talk about the establishment of the Climate Change Subcommittee of the EQB. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This will be brief. We are, as you all know, we're undertaking climate change comprehensive planning involving mitigation and adaptation. A big part of that will be the ICAT report, and that's a fantastic step in this process. So it's timely to create a subcommittee of the EQB, of EQB members, to help lead and guide this effort as we move forward. So there's a resolution in your packet that's pretty straightforward that calls for a vote today to establish a subcommittee, and as it says, I think it says on the resolution that as of now we have two commissioners, Commissioner Stein and Rothman, and two citizen members, Kate Knuth and John Saxhog, who have all agreed to serve on this subcommittee, and I believe there is room for more commissioners if any have time and inclination to also volunteer. Mr. Chair, I'll leave that to you to do the
prodding?
The lobbying on that, just wanted to put that out there. And then we do have a chart. Let's see if I can get this up here.
Right.
That will help. Thank you, Commissioners. Oh, boy, how am I going to find it? Commissioner Stein, thank you for suggesting. We just tried to put an org chart in front of you so you could start to see the relationship of the many interagency team efforts that are going on.
Yep.
So it's just one simple representational chart. Thank you, Paul. Beautiful. Thanks. And so this will just give you a sense of...
Paul, could you come back again next month?
He does such a good job. Yeah.
We know where he lives.
And so just to clarify here, the subcommittee obviously will be a part of the greater EQB. And its job will be to oversee the steering committee, which we've been convening on a monthly or sometimes twice a month basis to go through the coordination effort and to compile information from the agencies, much like Paul Moss has been doing. This team is adding in more focus on mitigation to complement that. But we have a number of existing interagency teams that are feeding into this effort, and I just wanted to put those out here so everyone can sort of try to keep that straight. There is the IPAT team, the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team, and that is overseen by MPCA, and their job is to really implement Executive Order 1113, which was the governor's executive order on sustainability in state government. Second is the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team, which you just heard from, coordinated by Paul Moss and the MPCA. And that report, we intend to have a comprehensive report and plan in over time that will incorporate both adaptation and mitigation, as I mentioned. So we're going to build very much on these great efforts of ICAT as we move forward. There's a Fleet Council, which is created as a spinoff of, it had another name previously. Thank you, Commissioner Kronk, in the led by the Commissioner of Administration, and they're focused on meeting the statutory goals for displacing fossil fuels in transportation. And finally, there's an Energy Efficiency Committee that is led by the Commerce Department that is focused on Executive Order 1112, and their core mission is to focus on energy efficiency and renewable energy improvements in state buildings. And so all of these teams are feeding information into this steering committee, and we've been reviewing all of that data, and there's a lot of overlap. But the agency representation on each of these teams is, each one is just a little different from the previous one. So they're not all exactly the same, but I'll mention ICAT, as you saw, is very close to the EQB representation. It does not include DEED, but it includes Homeland Security, Public Safety. So that's the only difference on ICAT. And so these other teams also have somewhat varying representation from different agencies. But there's a great deal of overlap with the EQB on all of these. And then the little box at the bottom shows you we have a team that's been assembled to work on trying to write and compile a first draft of our comprehensive framework planning first step. So I hope that's helpful. Any questions or discussion?
John?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to reiterate one thing that Ellen said, that all the things that are in light blue already exist. Mm-hmm. So they've been going on for a long time. And as a matter of fact, most of them were started over the last 10 years. And so these are just sort of, I think, an approach that I wanted to be sure we understood as a board that we're trying to, if it were my decision to recommend to the board, we want to support those ongoing efforts. We want to make them as effective as they can be by utilizing the other groups that will form, or the subcommittee that we intend to form, to help bring that policy discussion, more of a statewide policy discussion, to the bear, because I think these teams are looking for somewhere for all of this to feed when it comes to policy issues, state financial resource issues, and all kinds of other matters of concern. So I think that our work with the Governor's Institute for Community Design really set us on this path to say this is a team, sort of a charge for a subcommittee of EQB to really focus on this problem. And that's why I appreciate having this chart, just so we wouldn't lose track of who's who in the landscape of existing work.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond to that as well. I think that those are excellent points. And these teams are all doing an independent set of responsibilities that they have. I mean, I suppose to the outside person, this could look like a lot of teams, you know, a lot of entities. But they each have their own job to do, but what we're doing now under the auspices of the EQB is really, as you said, trying to bring together, we're asking them, what are the results of all this work, and bring that together so we can report it as part of our comprehensive approach to climate change led by the EQB. And so we're really trying to pull together some of the results of all these teams' good work over the last few years.
Thank you. Have you all had a chance to read the resolution? Is there, to get it in front of us, is there a motion?
I'll move.
There is a motion. Is there a second? There is a second. Now, discussion on the resolution.
I'd like to make an amendment. I'd like to add the Department of Health to one of the committee or to the subcommittee.
All right. You've heard the motion to amend to add the Department of Health to the subcommittee. Second. There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion to amend? If not, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. We're on the back on the resolution as amended.
Amendment carries.
Yes, I'm sorry. The amendment carries. On the resolution, we'll have a roll call vote when we're done, but are you ready to vote? Let's go ahead and call the roll.
Commissioner Clark Sieben?
Aye.
Commissioner Kronk?
Aye.
Ms. Duncanson?
Aye.
Commissioner Ellinger?
Aye.
Commissioner Fredrickson?
Aye.
Ms. Gehring?
Aye.
Ms. Knuth?
Aye.
Commissioner Landwehr?
Aye.
Commissioner Rothman?
Aye.
Mr. Saxog?
Aye.
Commissioner Stein?
Aye.
Mr. Tomlinson?
Aye.
It's unanimous. The motion prevails. Keep in mind, again, that there is room on the committee. There is also room in an ex officio capacity, so we welcome input from the members of the EQB.
Mr. Chair, can I just say two real quick things in closing. One is we will work with the members of the subcommittee to try to schedule a meeting sometime in the next few weeks, so you'll be hearing from us in terms of schedule. And secondly, I just wanted to put one little item out there that I had previously mentioned the need for some communications help for working on drafting the first iteration of our framework plan. And I'll send out something very soon in the next few days with a very specific request to commissioners to see if we have capacity for a professional writer and some graphics support. So you'll be hearing from me shortly on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add on that to a, even though we have just five agencies represented on the committee, we should understand that all of the agencies can contribute staff resources to pulling things together. I mean, none of us commissioners, well, I'm not as smart as most of my staff, so I would hope that if we had a group pulled together.
Is there a second?
that doesn't need a second. That's like a motion to adjourn. It does not need a second. So I will offer my staff to participate in some of those work groups as well.
You're a kind and good man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. All right. I think we're at the point in our discussion today to move forward with the Green Step City overview, and I want to welcome Ralph Nordstrom to the committee. Ralph is the executive director of the Great Plains Institute. Welcome, Ralph.
Good morning, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and distinguished members of the board. It's great for me to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today, and while Diana is getting things teed up, for those of you who don't know the Great Plains Institute, we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based here in the Twin Cities. We use consensus-based strategies to transform the energy system to be economically and environmentally sustainable. And I have to say, being where we are on the agenda, I feel there's a little, one of my favorite Far Side cartoons shows a picture of a classroom. And a kid raises his hand and he says, "Teacher, could I be excused? My brain is full." And I imagine that's the way you all feel right now. So hopefully there's just a little bit of room left in your brains after absorbing all of that cheerful data from the agencies. So the Great Plains Institute is a proud member of this public-private partnership that we want to talk to you about today called Green Step Cities. And actually, before I leap in, and we don't have a ton of slides, you'll be pleased to know. We have more than three, but we don't have a lot. On a personal note, I just want to say that it's an added privilege for me to be here at the EQB, because before I came to the Great Plains Institute, I devoted 10 years of my life working for the Environmental Quality Board. And I want to be clear, I'm not here to ask for my job back. But it is nice to be back, I guess. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I would say if you take just one thing away from our presentation in the next, say, 20 minutes, it's the title slide. We tried to use our slide space well. And that is that this voluntary statewide program called Green Step Cities could really, I think, if taken to its full potential, could be a kind of a common platform or a common framework within which agencies could deliver the community assistance that they're already delivering. It's just that it could be done in a way that the experience of the cities would be that that state assistance was coming to them in a more integrated, more coordinated fashion. So, Commissioner Stein mentioned sort of a similar theme earlier in the day. So, for example, you might think about if it's too bad that Commissioner Zelli is gone, but if the Department of Transportation were working in a city on a complete street, they had the streets dug up, they were doing work there, well, wouldn't that be a great time to be talking about better ways to manage stormwater at the same time, rather than each agency coming to that community separately and at a different time? You might imagine we'd get a more cost-effective, more sustainable solution in the end if there were a more coordinated delivery system, and we think Green Step Cities can be that. Also, on the heels of this, of the presentations you've had and the conversation you've had about climate adaptation, we think that the Green Step Cities program has two important features that could make it a really valuable vehicle for executing on these climate strategies, and that is that the Green Step Cities has developed really close and ongoing relationships with the senior management in cities. So it's not, you know, it's not just a one-time thing. There's a long-standing set of relationships now with the cities who've enrolled in the program. And so that's one feature that would make it valuable as a way to deliver climate adaptation and mitigation strategies that the state wants to help deploy. And the second is that many of the best practices that are embodied in the Green Step program, which you'll hear about in just a minute, actually have both climate mitigation and adaptation benefits. You get sort of a twofer for many of the best practices in there. So just quickly, these are the things that we're going to tick through, and you'll hear from my colleagues to the left here in just a couple of minutes. A little bit more about the program, a bit more about the best practices, and what kind of opportunity, again, this might represent for agencies going forward. You can see here that there are seven partners. This is a formal public-private partnership, and by formal, I mean that there's actually been an MOU executed among these organizations. It's already a couple of state agencies, and then importantly, the League of Minnesota Cities. Craig's going to talk about their involvement in just a minute. And it's really been a terrific collaboration right from the start, and I just want a shout out to the other partners who you're not hearing from today who actually make this whole thing go. We are just one cog in the wheel, the Great Plains Institute. So we're obviously biased about the program if that hasn't come through just yet. We think it's a darn good program. And as un-Minnesotan as it is, we actually thought it would be important to point out that we're not the only ones who think that the Green Step Cities program is a winner, literally in this case, because in 2012 we actually won two different awards from the Environmental Initiative, which many of you I'm sure know. One was in the Sustainable Communities category, and the other was Partnership of the Year. So this is all to say that we think Green Step Cities is a worthy program that has a lot of traction already, worthy of building on and leveraging to its greatest effect. So with that as preamble, let me turn it over to Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and he's just going to talk a little bit about why the League is involved and why this is valuable for cities. Craig.
Welcome, Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Rolf, for the kickoff on this. Again, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm one of those local partners you've been hearing about for the last couple of hours, and I'm glad to be the one that gets to come here and talk to you today. It's good timing for that. The League of Minnesota Cities, for those of you who don't maybe work with us as much as others, is the state association that represents the cities of the state on policy matters in front of state, federal agencies, and the state legislature, and works both as an advocacy group in that role, but also to educate our cities on better ways that they can do their functions, to assist them with questions they have about what their responsibilities are and how to meet them, and basically to provide clearinghouse-type information for them on everything from how to codify an ordinance package to, you know, how to deal with liability issues through our insurance trust. So we have a lot of fun with cities. And, in fact, the reason you lost one of your members here today is because this is the day of our final regional meeting of travels around the state for the year. It's the metropolitan area regional meeting, and there's a transportation policy panel at it that the commissioner is sitting on. So he's off meeting with regional partners. It's a good use of his time. We'd like him here, but it does make it, though, so that I get to take a shot back at the pothole comments without Commissioner Zelli here to defend himself and point out that, you know, the state aid formula could be better funded, and then we might have a little less potholes like MnDOT seems to be able to have, according to that said,
Chair, would Mr. Johnson consent to me delivering that message to Commissioner Zelli?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to have Commissioner Stein do that, and I think it'll be well received.
I think he'll love hearing it.
So, Mr. Done. Chair, to move on with the actual presentation instead of the fun here that we can have at the absentee's expense, cities work every day very, very, very deeply on environmental issues, whether it's an environmental mandate related to a permit they have to have for wastewater, stormwater, drinking water, or whether it's actually sitting down with their community and discussing what else do we want to do. As you're all well aware, both the people working in city government, the people elected to city government, and the people who live in our cities have a very much increasing expectation of energy and environmental sustainability and what local governments can and should be doing to address those issues in each community. And so Green Step Cities kind of grew a little bit out of that. We were receiving calls at the league regularly. What can we do? What should we look at? We've got citizens that want us to do something environmental. They don't know what they want. What should we do? And we don't have a good answer because every city is remarkably different, whether it's what they have for financial resources, land resources, previous work that they've already done. Just it's impossible to do that as a blanket kind of statement. So from the beginning, Green Step Cities was something that the league and some individual cities who were struggling with that worked with these partners to put together. How do we build a package that would help cities identify what would work in their community for, initially we talked about energy issues, but as we looked at it, we said, well, that's kind of silly because there's a lot of environmental stuff that we could be addressing at the same time. So let's make this package something that actually gets as many benefits as possible with one hit. And I think that's what we've found from the league's perspective with the Green Step Cities program. Our organization has, as I said, supported this at the board level annually since it was created. We have created a segment of our annual conference where cities who have achieved awards through the Green Step program receive those awards at our annual conference. And actually, it significantly drives turnout to that day of the conference as cities try and bring all of their staff and elected officials that want to get in the photo with the new third block of their award in the picture. So
I see you were in the picture also.
I was in that picture, yeah. I was kind of looking stern and trying not to smile too much.
As a Minnesotan, isn't that like pushing the envelope a little bit for self-congratulation?
Well, you'll notice I wasn't smiling.
Ah, okay. That's good. That's wasn't more Minnesota. That's
for
right.
For those who don't know, I grew up in the same part of the state that the chair spent a lot of his years in, and we don't smile out there unless
no,
we have to.
No.
So I think with that, we can go to the next slide. So to give you the idea, we currently have 57 cities literally across the state in the Green Step Cities program in one way or another. We actually have Elko and Newmarket now, one city, voting tomorrow, and they're expected to pass their resolution to be the 58th city. It covers 23% of the state's population. The range of cities involved in this, one of the things we worked very hard on in the early stages is to make this so that it was not a one-size-fits-all, and it was made to help everyone from small to large. So we go from Milan, population 326, to Rochester, population 109,000, and everything in between. The program has 28 best practices that cities can look at. As a roster, you're going to hear a lot more about all of this, I'm sure. There's 171 best practice actions that have occurred. 1,400 reports have come in from cities on how those actions have responded in improvements. And the cities are really lining up for this. I mean, our cities call us, ask us, what can we do? We now have something we can point them to and send them to. And I would add, it's not just cities that we send to Green Step Cities. I regularly send state agencies there. An agency will come and say, how can I get to cities to talk about this issue that we need to talk to them about that's environment or energy related? And I will say, well, it's funny you should mention that, because we have a mechanism. And we can do it through Green Step Cities and get to the cities that have already self-selected as places that want to work on this. And the last thing I would just like to emphasize that Rolf mentioned briefly is state agencies actually are very efficient and very effective already at working with programs that get out to local government. You do it every day. All of the agencies here do. All the other state agencies do. The difference is those typically go to the staff level of the implementing body of whatever government you're working with. So the public works director or the city engineer or the city attorney or whoever you're working with. This program really is aimed at the mayors, the city councils, and the chief elected or chief appointed officials in a community. You build the relationships there. They pass resolutions saying we want to do this, and then they form the community support to get the work done. So the citizen commissions, the ongoing relationships between the elected body and the advisory groups in their community. And it really makes it something that's not just a one and done where you get, you know, a $300 grant once to do some little project and then you never come back again. So I think that's what our cities have really found effective is this is a long-term relationship. It's a one-stop shop. And it really does come down to that they know that it's going to be there and that they can just keep going back for help when they get stuck. So with that, I'm very pleased that you're going to take a little time to hear about this, and I think you'll like what you hear from Lissa and others. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome, Lissa.
Thanks. My name is Lissa Polish, and I'm the statewide director of the Clean Energy Resource Teams, which is also a partnership program. I'm based at the University of Minnesota with the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships and Extension. We have been one of the Green Step Cities partners since the very beginning. And one of the things that really brought CERTS to this, we do a lot of work specifically on energy efficiency and renewable energy issues. And that was really sort of part of where Green Step started, and you both have touched on that it really has expanded beyond that. I didn't know that we were a comedy show, so I didn't get my act put together before we got here, and now I'm going to dive into like the real nitty-gritty of the program. I do smile, though, and a lot more than Craig. So I've got that going for me.
Yep.
Okay. So the Green Step Cities program is really broken into best practice categories, and you can see them listed here, and then best practices within that, and then actions. And Craig started to talk about this. I want to just point you to a couple of handouts that are in your packet, because I think that this might help make it more clear as well. You have sort of an overview, I'll hold these up, that describes it, and then you have a more detailed look at what the best practices are. The best practices span what cities do in lots of different departments with lots of different actors and different people involved. And in that same sort of way, they span what many of your agencies do. And part of the discussion that you've just had is sort of that perfect transition for why this might be a vehicle. What we're really trying to do is help people see what are those things that they can do to take action. Not think about it, not wonder about it, not call Craig and ask, what could I be doing? My community members don't know. But actually a real list. And when I say a list, I mean a serious list. This is what our website looks like as you get into the Green Step Cities program. And I want to just walk you through this a little bit so you understand some of the fundamentals of how this works. We actually really start with the notion that Craig emphasized, that no community is going to be the same as another. They're different. They're different in terms of their resource base, their natural resource base, but they're also very different in terms of their human resource base and the capacities that they have within their communities. So one of the things that you see up at the top right is this optional for all cities, Category C, Category A, Category B. We don't look at cities as monolithic. We understand that the capacity of Milan and the capacity of Rochester are not the same. And so what the steps are that we're asking cities to do as they start on this journey and keep going will be different and is tailored to what they can do. We call it Green Step Cities, and you heard the allusion to the step that they keep moving forward. When you first become a Green Step City, you get a little block. One, I mean, it's really, it's a cube. It's wood from the hood, painted green. It's got a cute little icon with our logo. And then when you do more best practices, you get two blocks. And as you do more best practices and take more action, you get three blocks. And we're currently working on what steps four or five and beyond look like for the program. But this is the place where they come and see, so is this one that we need to do to keep moving? Is this the one that's really going to be a good fit for us? And it's also where they start to look and see, what are the actions that really work in my local setting? So we understand that demand-side travel planning is not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach. So we provide actions that they can actually pick, move forward. And we also provide down here, you can see the why take action, the evidence for why you do that. What might you save? There's been reference to just solutions that make sense. They're going to make sense environmentally. They're going to make sense from an economic standpoint. We focus a lot on some of the economics of those practices. And this is the chance for us to show, what are the things that just make sense, that you can do this and it's going to be of benefit to your community? And how do you actually show that to your community? We also help provide tools to go deeper. So they're looking at the best practice action and they see that this is a real opportunity, but how do I actually do it? So we have these implementation tools to help take people deeper into, these are the actual steps, these are websites, these are other resource documents that already exist. Many of those are things that you all may have already created at your agencies, and we can direct people directly to them so they're not fumbling around wondering where they are, but here they are related to the action that they'd like to take. We also provide them with an opportunity to say, what have my peers already done? Nothing sells more to cities than what other cities have already done. And that's what we're talking about when we say proven best practices. People want to know what someone else has done. And as many Minnesotans, you don't really want to be the first one. You'd really like to be the second one. And so this is a chance to see where you could be, you know, that marvelous second or third person in the door taking an action, and see what other people have done, and actually have contact information for someone at a city that you could call and say, hey, how'd you do that? So that's one of the benefits of those reports. We also outline how this connects back to state policy, so that if they need more justification or are trying to figure out how do we tell our community that we're fulfilling these bigger ideas and fulfilling those bigger missions. And then there is the all-important Green Step Advisor. I don't know how many of you have ever thought, I wonder who would know about this topic. And you do a Google search, and you can find any number, thousands, hundreds of thousands of websites that could potentially answer that. But for me, what I'd most like to do is pick up the phone and call someone. I just want someone that I can ask a human being a question and say, how do we do that? And that's what Green Step Cities provides to all of these cities all around the state. We actually identify one person with their direct phone number and their direct email that you can call about each of these best practices. Right now, many of those best practice advisors are people at many of your agencies, and you can see that list here. But part of what we wanted to talk with all of you about today is the real opportunity, and I think Rolf referenced this in his opening comments, that we could do much more, and there's an opportunity to do more in really using Green Step Cities as a vehicle for delivering assistance to those communities in a coordinated, concerted way. The gentleman from the DNR talked a little bit earlier in his opening comments about we need a practical way to collaborate at the local level. And I think that Green Step Cities is a perfect opportunity to do just that.
Thank you.
Sorry, we have two more.
Mouse handoff.
The mouse handoff.
The baton. So, you know, based on the presentation we've given you in the last 15 minutes, you might think that we're here to pitch you something new. But in fact, EQB is way ahead of us. The first, as the slide suggests, way back in 1998, there was this recommendation to the EQB that the state should look at ways to deliver services to communities in a more efficient, proactive, and cooperative fashion to better build local capacity and take a systems approach. We're finally getting around to it. We're just catching up with you. And then more recently, several board members have mentioned already today the Governor's Institute on Community Design, and one of the recommendations from that process just this year was to develop an interagency sort of team of mid-level folks to figure out how do you truly institutionalize the kind of cross-agency collaboration that is probably both needed in terms of the problems we're trying to tackle. I mean, really, if you think about the way state government, and this is true at the federal level too, the way state government is organized,
And probably necessarily so. Each agency is given a very different set of tasks and a mission. But in the real physical world, those issues are all sort of intertwined and messy. And we see Green Step Cities as an opportunity to sort of bring some rationality to that mess and deliver the assistance that agencies already do, but in a kind of tidy package. This is sort of apocryphal, and maybe I won't even say the city, but there was a quite a large city that was considering joining Green Step initially, and at first they were like, I don't know, the best practices are good, but we're already doing most of that. It sort of felt like it wasn't advanced enough for them. But at the end, and I actually don't know what the status is, so I won't even say, but my understanding is the latest is that city is reconsidering joining Green Step, not because they felt like it could bring coherence to what otherwise felt like sort of a hodgepodge, disparate bundle of sustainability efforts at the city level that weren't necessarily, you know, tied together in any sort of coherent way, and that Green Step was attractive because it might provide that kind of a coherent framework for thinking about their actions. So it's not new. We're just finally getting around to it. And lastly, and this is the second to last slide if anybody's panicked, it would be important to think about if we're going to do this and if we have these best practices and here we are trying to help cities implement them, and if our wish were to come true and Green Step actually became kind of a common platform for both state agencies and frankly other nonprofit groups that deliver community assistance of one kind or another, if everybody began to use this common platform to deliver it, how would we measure impact? How would we know if that was making both cities and the state as a whole better or worse? Well, we've kind of taken a baby step in trying to answer that question. Thanks to Rick Carter at LHB, an architecture firm, and his colleague Michael Orange, and the Green Step partners and many others I won't name, this Regional Indicators Initiative, which you could Google and find, has begun to take shape. It's not a million metrics, but it's some key metrics given some of the best practices that are in Green Step. You can see for yourself, it's now they're collecting data from cities on these metrics: energy, water, vehicle miles traveled, and waste, and tracking impact on greenhouse gas reduction or growth and cost savings. I think it's important to note, especially since the Metropolitan Council is now here at the EQB, which is a great thing to see, that the Metropolitan Council recently embraced, I don't know what the right word is, both Green Step Cities and the Regional Indicators Initiative as two important tools to help, that they have decided they will use to help cities achieve the Metro 2040, Thrive Metro 2040 MSP, I've got that name wrong, Metro 20, Thrive MSP 2040 plan. Got it. I get a sucker afterwards for getting that. So, the Met Council has recognized, I think, already the value of Green Step and this Regional Indicators Initiative, that not only to help cities, but when at least when I think about this, I think maybe if we do this, if you sort of wrote this large and collected data over a long enough period of time and helped cities really track their performance on these things, it might actually help the state as a whole, agencies and the state as a whole, track our progress on a whole set of goals, a little like Minnesota Milestones aspired to do. And we'd end up with kind of a dashboard that we could, of measures that we could track over time. So that's it. That's what we have for you. So thanks very much again for the opportunity to go over this program. And I think all of us happy to stand for questions, and there are other partners in the audience if we are dumbfounded by one of your questions.
Rolf, I thought that maybe a couple of mayors were going to be here today. Are they?
Well, I confess, there was a little bit of a bait and switch there,
unintentional. Okay.
So there was a timeline, because the EQB needs to post the material well in advance for the public, we, to be honest, had not quite nailed down the mayor just yet.
Okay.
But Mayor Hovland of Edina was, I think, fully prepared to come. And in the end, we thought, given the amount of time he would have to speak.
You cut him then.
We did. Okay. We cut him. You're off the hook.
Thank you.
I want to say, though, for the record.
Just wanted that on the record.
He was fully prepared to make the commute. even at rush hour. To,
sure,
that's
easy
to hold
for you
it.
To say. Sure.
Yeah. I think you've got to.
All right. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I noticed only one in Northwest Minnesota. I don't know, Warren, Oslo, one of those. Do you have any idea why they haven't heard about it, or if there's one specific reason?
So it's actually, I want to check the map because Bemidji, Warren, and Black Duck have all signed on. Crookston is in the process of considering. We've been talking with Moorhead. We've been doing a lot of outreach. I think for many smaller communities, there is the sense of the capacity issue. And we talked a little bit about even just doing the reporting and sort of as you move forward in the steps, doing that reporting. And I think there's a little bit of, we are doing that. We don't need your brand to acknowledge that we are doing that. And yet, I do think that there are some benefits to being involved. And I think that that's part of the challenge for all of the partners involved is to make that case for there are other connections to resources and there are other resources that we leverage as part of that program and make it worth the while.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I was just curious. I thought that might be Warren. They're always on the cutting edge of it.
They are always on the cutting edge.
Probably will follow.
Yes.
Greg?
Mr. Chair, to that question, I think the perfect answer is that there's a lot of work going on up there. Mm-hmm. I think they're just starting to look at this as a way to coordinate their work. Word is starting to get out. So I think you'll see it more often up there.
Other Mr. comments? Chair, may I just make one
Please,
other comment?
Well, yeah.
So somebody mentioned earlier, the state of Minnesota, I guess, Deed has won this a spot with the National Governors Association, if you will, to basically target clean energy as a way to build that industry in the state. And this is a little presumptuous, but I could even imagine Green Step being helpful in that process, since we're already in touch with lots and lots of communities who want to do, and CERTS, the Clean Energy Resource Teams, are a partner in Green Step, and already working with lots and lots of communities who want to do clean energy projects, there's sort of a ready customer base, if you will, for cities wanting to, like, just let's go. So they might be a great, those cities who are participating, or at least some subset, might be a great partner for Deed in sort of making the most of that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that offer. And I know it's a cross-agency team that's working on this effort, and the first step is to really look from a policy perspective of how do we create the environment for that growth that helps support that growth. But as we get deeper into this work, we will definitely take you up on that offer.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Again, John?
Just quickly, I have to say that 58 is not enough, even if Elko and Newmarket join. Right? I mean, how many cities are there incorporated in the state, Craig?
Yeah. There are 854, but it drops to 853 on January 1st when Carlton and Thompson merge. So,
thanks. That was specific. I appreciate that. But I just,
Notice he did smile.
I'll smile for that.
The PCA has been very excited to host this program within our staff, and we want to continue to build it and grow it. But I also think that it's an opportunity for the EQB members to cross-promote, right? All of you work with their clients. And we want that cross promotion to occur because just like Ed is famous for saying, there's health in all policies, there's a green step in all communities, right? We need more of that adoption work going on locally. So, thank you for bringing this to the board,
Mr. Chair. May I just respond briefly to that?
Please.
There's one other thing. So, in addition to Green Step Cities, and in this case, it's just the Great Plains Institute. In the past year and a half or so, also convened a regional group because it turns out that Iowa and Wisconsin have what I'll call Green Step-like programs. They're called different things and they're run slightly differently, but there are some similarities as well. And one, in particular, in Iowa, they embed, and I'm mentioning this because I think it's a little counterintuitive. You can look at Green Step and think that it's mostly an environmental thing, which many of them, the practices are, but it has a real economic aspect to it too. And Iowa has captured that by putting in what they do in Iowa is embed Green Step City-like best practices in their economic development programs explicitly, both in the way they do disaster recovery, so that if you're going into a city that's had a flood and you're going to rebuild, they use a set of Green Step-like best practices and criteria to say, well, let's not just rebuild it the way we had it. Let's rebuild it better, and let's kind of take a systems approach to the way we rebuild this city so that it's better in every way. Cheaper, longer term to operate, more resilient, more climate adaptive, if you will. So I think there are opportunities even in agencies like DEED where it may not, it just may not seem automatically intuitive. Like, I'm not sure I connect with the Green Step thing.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. It seems to me that there must be the ability to sort of update this with new information as time goes, right? So it's kind of a dynamic thing. But I'm wondering, too, about the ability to use it for sort of regional initiatives. And the next subject on our agenda is silica sand update. And concurrent with that, there is a effort going on to look at model ordinances for a specific part of the state. So it doesn't have relevance to the whole part of the state. But is this the type – would this site be useful for something like that to deliver sort of a regional model or BMP, or and maybe Craig is familiar with as well the effort with the Mississippi River Critical Area, where there might be some new ordinances required by the state, but then maybe also some BMPs associated with that as sort of options. So that is, would this, do you think this would be amenable for that as well?
Craig?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I do think Green Step Cities could provide links to be a clearinghouse for that. I'm not as sure how it would fit into their best management practices. But I think some of us as partners, like the League, the example I can give is we have twice now worked with the Pollution Control Agency to develop a model ordinance for how to deal with contaminated sludge from cleaning out stormwater ponds that are contaminated with coal tar. The model ordinance has been developed by both and has been posted on the website of both with the same exact information on both. That's the way I would think we would most likely want to work on the silica sand thing, is to say, here's the resources that are available to you. Here's how you get in contact with each agency, with the EQB. You know, here's how you can get a model ordinance. Here's how you can get the list of BMPs for protecting trout streams, you know, whatever you end up with as tools. And I think at least as an aid in the clearinghouse, it would be effective. Could it be that there's a few BMPs that would fit in nicely into the package in southeast Minnesota? Maybe. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see what they look like, I guess.
So a follow-up question would be, you know, this is oriented towards cities, obviously. Is it useful for counties and townships?
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Well, and just to respond to your very first question, we do update the best practices annually so that as new information is coming out, we're able to have review sessions and have people contribute new ideas. Each of the best practice advisors also review their own best practice. And so, you know, they work in the field day to day, and we're using them as that touch point to be able to do that. There have been a number of different regional efforts and even just forums that we host around Green Step Cities, around certain best practice areas. So we've done them around, you know, say complete streets, and talked about both the public health benefits as well as in the transportation sector and that kind of thing. So there are opportunities for that. Okay, now I forgot your follow-up
question. Other units of government?
Oh, we have done an extensive study on how this could be applied to counties, because that's something that we've heard a lot about, and counties certainly are feeling that townships, even within those counties, sometimes are the sort of earliest adopters. Mm-hmm. I think there are certainly possibilities to do that. I think we're always at a sort of capacity challenge. I mean, we'd like to get really, really great at the city part first and get more of those 854, soon to be 853 cities to sign on before we start creating another program. And there are certainly some implications if we look at counties. There are some of the best practices as they stand right now that probably fit well for a county. And if they were then in a county program, we would need to figure out how we would handle that at the city level. Is that no longer part of the city program? Is it part of the city program if their host county isn't? So I think it's just a bit more complicated. But, yes, we've actually done a lot of thinking about it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Question for Mr. Johnson. How has the League let their members know about the Green Step program? I just sent a text to the mayor of Mapleton, Minnesota, and I want to know if he should have known this already, because this is perfect for the four little towns that I live amongst, and I know that some of this work has started. But how has the League let their members know?
Greg.
So, Mr. Chair and members, we have highlighted this as part of our annual conference since the program started. We include it in all of our updates that we send out to cities. Our webpage has a link on the front page that connects you to Green Step Cities. We regularly run updates on the program. We announce the awards in all of our publications. We actually do highlight this in most of our stuff. The regional meetings we just had around the state, which we hold in the smaller communities, mostly in the rural parts, and then we have one final one in the metro area. The table has a handout for how people can contact Green Step Cities on the table. So.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
If you don't hear from him, let me know.
Let me know. Now he's in trouble.
That was like the mayor's call.
Other questions or comments? Eric?
Just had a real quick comment to kind of follow up what Mr. Landwehr said about the silica sand mining. Could you go back to the slide that has your web page on it where it kind of identifies a couple of metrics, who to contact? And that sort of thing.
I think I could. Just hold on a sec here.
As I was looking at that.
Which one? Which slide?
This slide here.
Oh, this here.
Yeah. As I was looking at that, I started thinking about the silica sand subcommittee, or what we were hearing, or at least what I heard more than once from township's decision makers, were they'd like a toolbox, a decision-making toolbox. And I see this as kind of a framework for that, at least our delivery system, something similar to this. So,
good point.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, I mean, part of what we're providing as part of the legislation is a library, right? So it's a library of information, it's technical assistance team. So there'll be a group of people who contact information for them would be useful, but there will be some things that are, you know, the model ordinances, for instance, that will be cut and paste types of things that could be right on the website. So it is. If we didn't go with this, we should have something like this when we start talking about the EQB's role in silica sand.
All right. Well, Ralph, Craig, Lisa, thank you so much for being here today. And you're right, my head is starting to fill up. We've got one more agenda item
excused.
To go.
So
thank you
very
again.
Much.
No, we're not. Yeah, adjournment. The road to heck is paved with good intentions. I thought we'd be done by 2:30, 3 o'clock today, but I guess not. So, at this, we're usually out of here. At this time, I'd like Jeff to come up and give us an update on silica sand. Welcome, Jeff.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the board, to bring us back to the very beginning of the meeting, your opening comments, Mr. Chair, you and I learned a similar thing, but in my part of the state, if I entered a liquor store after 10 o'clock, it would make me a burglar, because they're supposed to be closed at 10. So I don't know how things work in your part of the state.
Oh, yes,
but,
they work very well.
You're wearing a
little
what?
Didn't know this was a comedy show. I swear.
Yeah. We're after the. We want to have the moniker that the EQB has fun.
That's right. That's a subcommittee that we need to form, right? Okay. Model silica sand update. Four things: model standards, the library, rulemaking, and the EIS. Mrs. Seufert noted that we completed the public meetings in October on the 25th and the 29th, had a pretty good turnout at all of them. The model standards themselves, the different pieces are being pulled together. There are people in different agencies working on different pieces of them. In the next few weeks, we are going to be pulling them together into a draft document. We're pretty much on schedule for our target date of releasing a draft on December 13th, but let's keep our fingers crossed. I mean, there's a lot of work to do, but I think we'll make it. We have received many, many comments. We are reviewing them as part of the whole process. We will have the public comment period is going to be opening about December 13th. Shortly after that, on December 18th, Mr. Seufert also noted that the silica sand subcommittee of the EQB will be meeting instead of the full board meeting.
And just a reminder, yes, that meeting is open to the public, just as all the EQB meetings are. And we will review the public comments as we get through that public comment period, revise the draft, and I think we're on schedule for completing the model standards in February. The schedule right now is that the board would vote on the model standards at the February meeting. So, so far, so good. A lot of great work being done by the members of a number of your different agencies, so we do appreciate all that. The library, there are some local government ordinances and permits on our website as part of the library. Long way to go, lest anybody think that that's done and they're looking and asking, where's ours? It's just not there yet. We are making progress. There's a few more that should be ready to get up there in the near future. So we're getting there little by little. The rulemaking, I think it was mentioned that there's a joint advisory committee being put together for the rulemaking. We did send out a notice on November 14th asking interested persons to contact the person in the MPCA who is putting that together. At this point, the PCA and the DNR are leading the formation of that advisory committee. EQB is participating as well. So we appreciate all the work being going into that. Regarding the EIS, we did have a letter that was sent out to update people. We sent out a draft cost agreement on October 30th for the scoping process, sent it to the project proposer. We've not received really a formal response. However, minutes before this meeting began, I did receive an email from the project proposer's consultant saying, yes, we got your message asking if we got it. The project proposer has been busy with the harvest and hasn't been able to deal with it, so they expect to pick it up shortly, possibly next week. Of course, bear in mind that's Thanksgiving week, so I don't expect an awful lot of progress to be made on it. But things may be moving along again, so that's good. Our executive director sent out an update letter to county administrators down on a number of areas just to let them know we haven't forgotten about all this. It's still happening. Here's where we're at with it. We have a project manager, as was announced earlier, awaiting finalization or finalizing of that draft of that cost agreement. And more importantly, it's the middle of the money, because without the money, we don't have any money to pay anybody to be a contract manager. So that's what I have to say. I can certainly answer any questions the board might have.
Questions for Jeff from any of the board members? Seeing none, Jeff, thank you. I believe that completes the business, with exception of any opportunity for some public comment. No one is asked to testify on any of the issues, but I certainly want to make this time available to anyone who would choose to comment. Seeing none, I believe a motion to adjourn is in order.
So moved.
Second.
There is a motion. There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion carries.